photocopying machine was a monster, and she had over 500 reams of paper stacked out back. If she could get Pete Freeman to help her, or Tony Gay, who covered sports. Horace, meanwhile, had finally assumed the position. When he was done, she swung into action with a small green bag labeled Doggy Doo. Wondering to herself what Horace Greeley would have thought of a world where picking up dog shit from the gutter was not just socially expected, but a legal responsibility. She thought he might have shot himself. Once the bag was filled and tied off, she tried her phone again. Nothing. She took Horace back inside and fed him. 4. Her cell rang while she was buttoning her coat to drive out to the barrier. She had her camera over her shoulder and almost dropped it, scrabbling in her pocket. She looked at the number and saw the words, "Private Caller." "Hello?" she said. And there must have been something in her voice, because Horace, waiting by the door, more than ready for a nighttime expedition now that he was cleaned out and fed, pricked up his ears and looked around at her. "Mrs. Shumway?" A man's voice, clipped, official sounding.
"Ms. Shumway, to whom am I speaking?"
"Colonel James Cox, Ms. Shumway, United States Army."
"And to what do I owe the honor of this call?"
She heard the sarcasm in her voice and didn't like it. It wasn't professional, but she was afraid, and sarcasm had ever been her response to fear. "I need to get in touch with a man named Dale Barbara. Do you know this man?" Of course she did, and had been surprised to see him at Sweetbriar earlier tonight. He was crazy to still be in town, and hadn't Rose herself said just yesterday that he had given notice? Dale Barbara's story was one of hundreds Julia knew but hadn't written. When you published a small-town newspaper, you left the lids on a great many cans of worms. You had to pick your fights, the way she was sure Junior Rennie and his friends picked theirs. And she doubted very much if the rumors about Barbara and Doty's good friend Angie were true, anyway. For one thing, she thought Barbara had more taste. "Ms. Shumway." Crisp, official, and on-the-outside voice. She could resent the owner of the voice just for that. "Still with me?"
"Still with you, yes. I know Dale Barbara. He cooks at the restaurant on Main Street. Why?"
"He has no cell phone, it seems. The restaurant doesn't answer."
"It's closed."
"And the landlines don't work, of course."
"Nothing in this town seems to work very well tonight, Colonel Cox. Cell phones included. But I notice you didn't have any trouble getting through to me, which makes me wonder if you fellows might not be responsible for that."
Her fury, like her sarcasm born of fear, surprised her.
"What did you do? What did you people do?"
"Nothing. So far as I know now, nothing." She was so surprised she could think of no follow-up, which was very unlike the Julia Shumway longtime mill residents knew. "The cell phones, yes," he said. "Calls in and out of Chester's Mill are pretty well shut down now, in the interests of national security. And with all due respect, ma'am, you would have done the same in our position."
"I doubt that."
"Do you?" He sounded interested, not angry. "In a situation that's unprecedented in the history of the world and suggestive of technology far beyond what we or anyone else can even understand?" Once more, she found herself stuck for a reply. "It's quite important that I speak to Captain Barbara," he said, returning to his original scripture. In a way, Julia was surprised he'd wandered as far off message as he had.
"Captain Barbara?"
"Retired. Can you find him? Take your cell phone. I'll give you a number to call. It'll go through."
"Why me, Colonel Cox? Why didn't you call the police station, or one of the town's selectmen? I believe all three of them are here."
"I didn't even try. I grew up in a small town, Ms. Shumway."
"Bully for you."
"And in my experience, town politicians know a little, the town cops know a lot, and the local newspaper editor knows everything." That made her laugh in spite of herself.
"Why bother with a call when you two can meet face to face, with me as your chaperone, of course? I'm going out to my side of the barrier, was leaving when you called. In fact, I'll hunt Barbie up."
"Still calling himself that, is he?"
Cox sounded bemused. "I'll hunt him up and bring him with me. We can have a mini press conference."
"I'm not in Maine, I'm in D.C. with the Joint Chiefs."
"Is that supposed to impress me?"
Although it did, a little. Ms. Shumway, I'm busy, and probably you are, too, so in the interest of resolving this thing...
Is that possible, do you think?
Quit it, he said. You are undoubtedly a reporter before you were an editor, and I'm sure asking questions comes naturally to you, but time is a factor here. Can you do as I ask?
I can, but if you want him, you get me, too. We'll come out 119 and call you from there.
No, he said.
That's fine, she said pleasantly. It's been very nice talking to you, Colonel C...
Let me finish. Your side of 119 is totally foobar. That means...
I know the expression, Colonel. I used to be a Tom Clancy reader. What exactly do you mean by it in regard to Route 119?
I mean it looks like, pardon the vulgarity, opening night at a free whorehouse out there. Half your town has parked their cars and pickups on both sides of the road and in some dairy farmer's field.
She put her camera on the floor, took a notepad from her coat pocket, and scrawled Colonel James Cox, and, like open night at Free W House. Then she added Dinsmore Farm? Question mark. Yes, he was probably talking about Alden Dinsmore's place. All right, she said. What do you suggest?
Well, I can't stop you from coming. You're absolutely right about that.
He sighed, the sound seeming to suggest it was an unfair world.
And I can't stop what you print in your paper, although I don't think it matters, since no one outside of Chester's Mill is going to see it.
She stopped smiling. Would you mind explaining that?
I would, actually, and you'll work it out for yourself. My suggestion is that if you want to see the barrier, although you can't actually see it, as I'm sure you've been told, you bring Captain Barbara out to where it cuts Town Road Number 3. Do you know Town Road Number 3? For a moment she didn't. Then she realized what he was talking about and laughed. Something amusing, Ms. Shumway.
In the mill, folks call that one Little Bitch Road, because in mud season it's one little bitch.
Very colorful.
No crowds out on Little Bitch, I take it.
No one at all right now.
All right. She put the pad in her pocket and picked up the camera.
Horace continued waiting patiently by the door. Good. When may I expect your call, or rather Barbie's call, on your cell?
She looked at her watch and saw it had just gone 10. How in God's name had it gotten that late so early? We'll be out there by 10:30. Assuming I can find him. And I think I can.
That's fine.
Tell him Ken says hello.
That's a...
A joke? Yes, I get it. Will someone meet us?
There was a pause.
When he spoke again, she sensed reluctance.
There will be lights and sentries and soldiers manning a roadblock, but they have been instructed not to speak to the residents.
Not to... Why, in God's name... Why?
If the situation doesn't resolve, Ms. Shumway, all these things will become clear to you. Most you really will figure out on your own. You sound like a very bright lady.
Well, fuck you very much, Colonel, she cried, stung.
At the door, Horace pricked up his ears. Cox laughed, a big unoffended laugh. Yes, ma'am. Receiving you 5 by 5. 10:30?
She was tempted to tell him no, but of course there was no way she could do that. 10:30, assuming I can hunt him up, and I call you?
Either you or him, but it's him I need to speak with. I'll be waiting with one hand on the phone.
Then give me the magic number.
She crooked the phone against her ear and fumbled the pad out again. Of course you always wanted your pad again after you'd put it away. That was a fact of life when you were a reporter,
which she now was. Again.
The number he gave her to call somehow scared her more than anything else he'd said.
The area code was 000.
One more thing, Miss Shumway. Do you have a pacemaker implant, hearing aid implants, anything of that nature?
No. Why?
She thought he might again decline to answer, but he didn't. Once you're close to the dome, there's some kind of interference. It's not harmful to most people. They feel it as nothing more than a low-level electric shock which goes away a second or two after it comes. But it plays hell with electronic devices. Shut some down. Most cell phones, for instance, if they come closer than 5 feet or so. and explodes others. If you bring a tape recorder out, it'll shut down. Bring an iPod or something sophisticated like a BlackBerry, it's apt to explode.
Did Chief Perkins' pacemaker explode? Is that what killed him?
10:30, bring Barbie and be sure to tell him Ken says hello. He broke the connection, leaving Julia standing in silence beside her dog. She tried calling her sister in Lewiston. The numbers beeped. Then nothing. Blank silence, as before. The dome, she thought. He didn't call it the barrier there at the end. He called it the dome. 5. Barbie had taken off his shirt and was sitting on his bed to untie his sneakers when the knock came at the door, which one reached by climbing an outside flight of stairs on the side of Sanders' hometown drug. The knock wasn't welcome. He had walked most of the day, then put on an apron and cooked for most of the evening. He was beat. And suppose it was Junior and a few of his friends, ready to throw him a welcome back party. You could say it was unlikely, even paranoid, but the day had been a festival of unlikely. Besides Junior and Frank, the Lessips and the rest of their little band were among the few people he hadn't seen at Sweetbriar tonight. He supposed they might be out on 119 or 117, rubbernecking, but maybe somebody had told them he was back in town, and they'd been making plans for later tonight. Later like now. The knock came again. Barbie stood up and put a hand on the portable TV. Not much of a weapon, but it would do some damage if thrown at the first one who tried to cram through the door. There was a wooden closet rod, but all three rooms were small, and it was too long to swing effectively. There was also his Swiss Army knife, but he wasn't going to do any cutting. Not unless he had to...
Mr. Barbara.
It was a woman's voice.
Barbie, are you in there?
He took his hand off the TV and crossed the kitchenette. Who is it? But even as he asked, he recognized the voice.
Julia Shumway, I have a message from someone who wants to speak to you. He told me to tell you that Ken says hello.
Barbie opened the door and let her in. 6. In the pine-paneled basement conference room of the Chester's Mill Town Hall, the roar of the generator out back, an elderly Kelvinator, was no more than a dim drone. The table in the center of the room was handsome red maple, polished to a high gleam, 12 feet long. Most of the chairs surrounding it were empty that night. The four attendees of what Big Jim was calling the emergency assessment meeting were clustered at one end. Big Jim himself, although only the second selectman, sat at the head of the table. Behind him was a map, showing the athletic sock shape of the town. Those present were the selectman and Peter Randolph, the acting chief of police. The only one who seemed entirely with it was Rennie. Randolph looked shocked and scared. Andy Sanders was, of course, dazed with grief, and Andrea Grinnell, an overweight, graying version of her younger sister Rose, just seemed dazed. This was not new. 4 or 5 years previous, Andrea had slipped in her icy driveway while going to the mailbox one January morning. She had fallen hard enough to crack 2 discs in her back. Being 80 or 90 pounds overweight probably hadn't helped. Dr. Haskell had prescribed that new wonder drug, OxyContin, to ease what had been no doubt excruciating pain, and had been giving it to her ever since. Thanks to his good friend Andy, who ran the local drugstore, Big Jim knew that Andrea had begun it 40 milligrams a day, and had worked her way up to a giddy 400. This was useful information. Big Jim said, "Due to Andy's great loss, I'm gonna chair this meeting if no one objects. We're all very sorry, Andy."
"You bet, sir," Randolph said.
"Thank you," Andy said, and when Andrea briefly covered his hand with her own, he began to ooze at the eyes again. "Now, we all have an idea of what's happened here," Big Jim said, "although no one in town understands it yet."
"I bet no one out of town does either," Andrea said.
Big Jim ignored her.
"And the military presence hasn't seen fit to communicate with the town's elected officials."
"Problems with the phone, sir," Randolph said.
He was on a first-name basis with all of these people. In fact, considered Big Jim a friend, but in this room, he felt it wise to stick to sir or ma'am. Perkins had done the same, and on that, at least, the old man had probably been right. Big Jim waved a hand as if swatting at a troublesome fly.
Someone could have come to the Martin or Tarker side and sent for me, us, and no one has seen fit to do so.
Sir, the situation is still very, fluid.
I'm sure, and it's very possible that's why no one has put us in the picture just yet. Could be, oh yes, and I pray that's the answer. I hope you've all been praying.
They nodded dutifully. But right now, Big Jim looked around gravely. He felt grave, but he also felt excited and ready. He thought it not impossible that his picture would be on the cover of Time magazine before the year was out. Disaster, especially the sort triggered by terrorists, was not always a completely bad thing.
Look what it had done for Rudy Giuliani. Right now, lady and gentlemen, I think we have to face the very real possibility that we are on our own.
Andrea put a hand to her mouth. Her eyes shone either with fear or too much dope, possibly both.
Surely not, Jim.
Hope for the best, prepare for the worst. That's what Claudette always says.
Andy spoke in tones of deep meditation.
Said, I mean. She made me a nice breakfast this morning. Scrambled eggs and leftover taco cheese. Gosh.
The tears, which had slowed, began to ooze again. Andrea once more covered his hand. This time Andy gripped it.
Andy and Andrea, Big Jim thought,
and a thin smile creased the lower half of his fleshy face. The Dumsey twins.
Hope for the best, plan for the worst, he said. What good advice that is.
The worst in this case could entail days cut off from the outside world, or a week. Possibly even a month. He didn't actually believe that, but they'd be quicker to do what he wanted if they were frightened.
Andrew repeated, Surely not.
We just don't know, Big Jim said.
This at least was the unvarnished truth.
How can we?
Maybe we ought to close Food City, Randolph said. At least for the time being. If we don't, it's apt to fill up, like, before a blizzard. Rennie was annoyed. He had an agenda, and this was on it, but it wasn't first on it. Or maybe that's not a good idea, Randolph said, reading the second selectman's face.
Actually, Pete, I don't think it's a good idea, Big Jim said. Same principle as never declaring a bank holiday when currency is tight. You only provoke a run.
Are we talking about closing the banks, too? Andy asked. What'll we do about the ATMs? There's one at Brownie's store. Mill, gas, and grocery. My drugstore, of course.
He looked vague, then brightened.
I think I even saw one at the health center, although I'm not entirely sure about that one.
Rennie wondered briefly if Andrea had been loaning the man some of her pills. I was only making a metaphor, Andy. Keeping his voice low and kind, this was exactly the kind of thing you could expect when people wandered off the agenda. In a situation like this, food is money, in a manner of speaking. What I'm saying is, it should be business as usual. It'll keep people calm.
Ah,
Randolph said. This he understood.
Gotcha. But you'll need to talk to the supermarket manager. What's his name, Cade?
Kale. Randolph said. Jack Kale.
Also, Johnny Carver at the gas and grocery, and who in the heck runs Brownies since Dill Brown died?
Thelma Winter, Andrea said. She's from away, but she's very nice.
Rennie was pleased to see Randolph writing the names down in his pocket notebook.
Tell those three people that beer and liquor sales are off
until further notice. His face cramped in a rather frightening expression of pleasure. And Dippers is closed. A lot of people aren't going to like a booze shutdown, Randolph said. People like Sam Verdreau.
Verdreau was the town's most notorious tosspot, a perfect example, in Big Jim's opinion, of why the Volstead Act should never have been repealed.
Sam and the others like him will just have to suffer once their current supplies of beer and coffee brandy are gone. We can't have half the town getting drunk like it was New Year's Eve.
Why not? Andrea asked. They'll use up the supplies, and that'll be the end of it.
And if they riot in the meantime?
Andrea was silent. She couldn't see what people would have to riot about, not if they had food. But arguing with Jim Rennie, she had found, was usually unproductive and always wearying.
I'll send a couple of the guys out to talk to them, Randolph said.
Talk to Tommy and Willow Anderson personally.
The Andersons ran dippers. They can be troublesome. He lowered his voice.
Wing nuts.
Randolph nodded. Left-wing nuts. Got a picture of Uncle Barack over the bar.
That's it exactly.
And, he didn't need to say, Duke Perkins let those two hippie cotton pickers get a foothold with their dancing and loud rock and roll and drinking until 1 in the morning. Protected them, and look at the trouble it led to for my son and his friends. He turned to Andy Sanders.
Also, you've got to put all the prescription drugs under lock and key.
Oh, not Nasonex and Lyrica, that sort of thing. You know the stuff I mean.
Anything people might use to get high, Andy said, is already under lock and key.
He seemed uneasy at this turn of the conversation. Rennie knew why, but he wasn't concerned about their various sales endeavors just now. They had more pressing business.
Better take extra precautions, just the same.
Andrea was looking alarmed. Andy patted her hand.
Don't worry, he said. We always have enough to take care of those in real need.
Andrea smiled at him.
Bottom line is, this town is going to stay sober until the crisis ends, Big Jim said. Are we in agreement? Show of hands.
The hands went up.
Now, Rennie said, may I go back to where I wanted to start?
He looked at Randolph, who spread his hands in a gesture that simultaneously conveyed, go ahead, and sorry.
We need to recognize that people are apt to be scared. And when people are scared, they can get up to Dickens, booze or no booze.
Andrea looked at the console to Big Jim's right, switches that controlled the TV, the AM-FM radio, and the built-in taping system, an innovation Big Jim hated.
Shouldn't that be on?
I see no need.
The darned taping system, shades of Richard Nixon, had been the idea of a meddling medico named Eric Everett, a 30-something pain in the buttinsky, who was known around town as Rusty. Everett had sprung the taping system idiocy at town meeting 2 years before, presenting it as a great leap forward. The proposal came as an unwelcome surprise to Rennie, who was seldom surprised, especially by political outsiders. Big Jim had objected that the cost would be prohibitive. This tactic usually worked with thrifty Yankees. But not that time. Everett had presented figures, possibly supplied by Duke Perkins, showing that the federal government would pay 80%, some disaster assistance, whatever, a leftover from the free-spending Clinton years. Rennie had found himself outflanked. It wasn't a thing that happened often, and he didn't like it. But he had been in politics for many more years than Eric Rusty Everett had been tickling prostates, and he knew there was a big difference between losing a battle and losing the war.
Or at least someone should take notes, Andrea asked timidly.
I think it might be best to keep this informal for the time being, Big Jim said, just among the four of us.
Well, if you think so.
Two can keep a secret if one of them is dead, Andy said dreamily.
That's right, pal, Rennie said, just as if that made sense.
Then he turned back to Randolph.
I'd say our prime concern, our prime responsibility to the town, is maintaining order for the duration of this crisis, which means police.
Damn straight, Randolph said smartly.
Now, I'm sure Chief Perkins is looking down on us from above.
With my wife, Andy said. with Claudie.
He produced a snot-clogged honk that Big Jim could have done without. Nonetheless, he patted Andy's free hand.
That's right, Andy, the two of them together bathed in Jesus' glory. But for us here on Earth.
Pete, what kind of force can you muster?
Big Jim knew the answer. He knew the answers to most of his own questions. Life was easier that way. There were 18 officers on the Chester's Mill police payroll, 12 full-timers, and 6 part-timers, the latter all past 60, which made their services entrancingly cheap. Of those 18, he was quite sure 5 of the full-timers were out of town. They had either gone to that day's high school football game with their wives and families, or to the controlled burn in Castle Rock. The 6th, Chief Perkins, was dead. And while Rennie would never speak ill of the dead, he was sure the town was better off with Perkins in heaven rather than down here, trying to manage a cluster mug that was far beyond his limited abilities.
"I'll tell you what, folks," Randolph said, "it's not that good. There's Henry Morrison and Jackie Weddington, both of whom responded with me to the initial Code 3. There's also Roop, Libby, Fred Denton, and George Frederick, although his asthma's so bad I don't know how much use he'll be. He was planning to take early retirement at the end of this year."
"Poor old George," Andy said. "He just about lives on Advair."
"And as you know, Marty Arsenal and Toby Whalen aren't up to much these days. The only part-timer I'd call really able-bodied is Linda Everett. Between that damn firefighting exercise and the football game, this couldn't have happened at a worse time."
"Linda Everett?" Andrea asked, a little interested. "Rusty's wife?"
"Pshaw!" Big Jim often said pshaw when he was irritated. "She's just a jumped-up crossing guard."
"Yes, sir," Randolph said, "but she qualified on the county range over in the Rock last year, and she has a sidearm. No reason she can't carry it and go on duty. Maybe not full-time. The Everetts have got a couple of kids, but she can pull her weight. After all, it is a crisis."
"No doubt, no doubt."
But Rennie was damned if he was going to have Everetts popping up like darned old jack-in-the-boxes every time he turned around. Bottom line, he didn't want that cotton picker's wife on his first team. For one thing, she was still quite young, no more than 30, and pretty as the devil. He was sure she'd be a bad influence on the other men. Pretty women always were. Weddington and her gunshell titties were bad enough.
"So," Randolph said, "that's only 8 out of 18.
"You forgot to count yourself," Andrea said.
Randolph hit his forehead with the heel of his hand as if trying to knock his brains back into gear.
"Oh, yeah, right, 9.
"Not enough," Rennie said. "We need to beef up the force. Just temporarily, you know, until the situation works itself out."
"Who were you thinking about, sir?"
Randolph asked.
"My boy, to begin with."
"Junior?" Andrea raised her eyebrows. "He's not even old enough to vote, is he?"
Big Jim briefly visualized Andrea's brain. 15% favorite online shopping sites, 80% dope receptors, 2% memory, and 3% actual thought process. Still, it was what he had to work with. And, he reminded himself, the stupidity of one's colleagues makes life simpler.
"He's 21, actually 22, in November, and either by luck or the grace of God, he's home from school this weekend."
Peter Randolph knew that Junior Rennie was home from school permanently. He'd seen it written on the phone pad in the late chief's office earlier in the week. Although he had no idea how Duke had gotten the information or why he'd thought it important enough to write down. Something else had been written there, too. "Behavioral issues?" This was probably not the time to share such information with Big Jim, however. Rennie was continuing, now in the enthusiastic tones of a game show host announcing a particularly juicy prize in the bonus round. "And Junior has 3 friends who would also be suitable, Frank DeLessives, Melvin Searles, and Carter Thibodeau." Andrea was once more looking uneasy.
"Weren't those boys, the young men, involved in that altercation at Dipper's?"
Big Jim turned a smile of such genial ferocity on her that Andrea shrank back in her seat. That business was overblown, and sparked by alcohol, as most such trouble is. Plus, the instigator was that fellow Barbara, which is why no charges were filed. It was a wash, or am I wrong, Peter? Absolutely not, Randolph said, although he too looked uneasy.
These fellows are all at least 21, and I believe Carter Thibodeau might be 23.
Thibodeau was indeed 23 and had lately been working as a part-time mechanic at Mill Gas and Grocery. He'd been fired from two previous jobs. Temper issues, Randolph had heard, but he seemed to have settled down at the gas and grocery. Johnny said he'd never had anyone so good with exhaust and electrical systems.
They've all hunted together. They're good shots.
Please, God, we don't have to put that to the test,
Andrea said. No one's going to get shot, Andrea, and no one's suggesting we make these young fellows full-time police. What I'm saying is that we need to fill out an extremely depleted roster, and fast. So how about it, Chief? They can serve until the crisis is over, and we'll pay them out of the contingency fund.
Randolph didn't like the idea of Junior toting a gun on the streets of Chester's Mill. Junior with his possible behavioral issues. But he also didn't like the idea of bucking Big Jim. And it really might be a good idea to have a few extra wide bodies on hand, even if they were young. He didn't anticipate problems in town, but they could be put on crowd control out where the main roads hit the barrier. If the barrier was still there. And if it wasn't, problems solved. He put on a team player smile. You know, I think that's a great idea, sir. You send him around to the station tomorrow around 10.
9 might be better, Pete.
9's fine, Andy said in his dreamy voice.
Further discussion? Rennie asked.
There was none. Andrea looked as if she might have had something to say, but couldn't remember what it was.
Then I call the question, Rennie said. Will the board ask Acting Chief Randolph to take on Junior, Frank DeLesseps, Melvin Searles, and Carter Thibodeau as deputies at base salary? Their period of service to last until this darn crazy business is sorted out. Those in favor signify in the usual manner. They all raise their hands. The measure is approved.
He was interrupted by two reports that sounded like gunfire. They all jumped. Then a third came, and Rennie, who had worked with motors for most of his life, realized what it was.
Relax, folks, just a backfire. Generator clearing its throat.
The elderly Jenny backfired a fourth time, then died. The lights went out, leaving them for a moment in Stygian blackness. Andrea shrieked. On his left, Andy Sanders said,
"Oh my gosh, Jim, the propane!"
Rennie reached out with his free hand and grabbed Andy's arm. Andy shut up. As Rennie was relaxing his grip, light crept back into the long, pine-paneled room. Not the bright overheads, but the emergency box lights mounted in the four corners. In their weak glow, the faces clustered at the conference table's north end looked yellow and years older. They looked frightened. Even Big Jim Rennie looked frightened.
No problem, Randolph said with a cheeriness that sounded manufactured rather than organic. Tank just ran dry, that's all. Plenty more in the town supply barn.
Andy shot Big Jim a look. It was no more than a shifting of the eyes. But Rennie had an idea. Andrea saw it. What she might eventually make of it was another question.
She'll forget it after her next dose of oxy, he told himself.
By morning, for sure. And in the meantime, the town's supplies of propane, or lack thereof, didn't concern him much. He would take care of that situation when it became necessary.
Okay, folks, I know you're as anxious to get out of here as I am, so let's move on to our next order of business.
I think we should officially confirm Pete here as our chief of police, pro tem.
Yes. Why not?
Andy asked. He sounded tired.
If there's no discussion, Big Jim said, I'll call the question.
They voted as he wanted them to vote.
They always did.
7. Junior was sitting on the front step of the big Rennie home on Mill Street when the lights of his father's Hummer splashed up the driveway. Junior was at peace. The headache had not returned. Angie and Dodie were stored in the McCain pantry, where they would be fine, at least for a while. The money he'd taken was back in his father's safe. There was a gun in his pocket, the Pearl Grip 38 his father had given him for his 18th birthday. Now he and his father would speak. Junior would listen very closely to what the King of No Money Down had to say. If he sensed his father knew what he, Junior, had done, he didn't see how that was possible, but his father knew so much. Then Junior would kill him. After that, he would turn the gun on himself. Because there would be no running away. Not tonight. Probably not tomorrow, either. On his way back, he had stopped on the town common and listened to the conversations going on there. What they were saying was insane, but the large bubble of light to the south, and the smaller one to the southwest, where 117 ran toward Castle Rock, suggested that tonight, insanity just happened to be the truth. The door of the Hummer opened, chunked closed. His father walked toward him, his briefcase banging one thigh. He didn't look suspicious, wary, or angry. He sat down beside Junior on the step without a word. Then, in a gesture that took Junior completely by surprise, he put a hand on the younger man's neck and squeezed gently. "You heard?" he asked. "Some," Junior said. "I don't understand it, though." "None of us do. I think there are going to be some hard days ahead while this gets sorted out. So I have to ask you something." "What's that?" Junior's hand closed around the butt of the pistol. "Will you play your part, you and your friends, Frankie, Carter, and the Searles boy?" Junior was silent, waiting. What was this shit? "Peter Randolph's acting chief now. He's going to need some men to fill out the police roster. Good men. Are you willing to serve as a deputy until this damn cluster mug is over?" Junior felt a wild urge to scream with laughter, or triumph, or both. Big Jim's hand was still on the nape of his neck, not squeezing, not pinching, almost caressing. Junior took his hand off the gun in his pocket. It occurred to him that he was still on a roll. The roll of all rolls. Today, he had killed two girls he'd known since childhood. Tomorrow, he was going to be a town cop. "Sure, Dad," he said. "If you need us, we are there." And for the first time in maybe 4 years, it could have been longer, he kissed his father's cheek. Prayers. 1. Barbie and Julia Shumway didn't talk much. There wasn't much to say. Theirs was, as far as Barbie could see, the only car on the road. But light streamed from most of the farmhouse windows once they cleared town. Out here, where there were always chores to be done and no one fully trusted Western Maine power, almost everyone had a Jenny. When they passed the WCIK radio tower, the two red lights at the top were flashing as they always did. The electric cross in front of the little studio building was also lit, a gleaming white beacon in the dark. Above it, the stars spilled across the sky in their usual extravagant profusion, a never-ending cataract of energy that needed no generator to power it. "Used to come fishing out this way," Barbie said. "It's peaceful." "Any luck?"
"Plenty, but sometimes the air smells like the dirty underwear of the gods, fertilizer or something. I never dared to eat what I caught."
"Not fertilizer, bullshit. Also known as the smell of self-righteousness."
"I beg your pardon?"
She pointed at a dark steeple shape blocking out the stars.
"Christ the Holy Redeemer Church," she said. "They own WCIK just back the road. Sometimes known as Jesus Radio."
He shrugged. "I guess maybe I have seen the steeple. And I know the station. Can't very well miss it if you live around here and own a radio. Fundamentalist?"
"They make the hard-shell Baptists look soft. I go to the Congo myself. Can't stand Lester Coggins. Hate all the ha-ha, you're going to hell and we're not stuff. Different strokes for different folks, I guess. Although I have often wondered how they afford a 50,000-watt radio station."
"Love offerings?"
She snorted.
"Maybe I ought to ask Jim Rennie. He's a deacon."
Julia drove a trim Prius hybrid, a car Barbie would not have expected of a staunch Republican newspaper owner, although he supposed it did fit a worshiper at the First Congregational. But it was quiet, and the radio worked. The only problem was that out here on the western side of town, CIK's signal was so powerful it wiped out everything on the FM band.
and tonight it was broadcasting some holy accordion shit that hurt Barbie's head. It sounded like polka music played by an orchestra dying of bubonic plague.
"Try the AM band, why don't you?" she said.
He did, and got only nighttime gabble, until he hit a sports station near the bottom of the dial. Here, he heard that before the Red Sox-Mariners playoff game at Fenway Park, there had been a moment of silence for the victims of what the announcer called the Western Main event.
"Event," Julia said. "A sports radio term if I ever heard one. Might as well turn it off."
A mile or so past the church, they began to see a glow through the trees. They came around a curve and into the glare of lights almost the size of Hollywood premier Kleeg's. Two pointed in their direction. Two more were tilted straight up. Every pothole in the road stood out in stark relief. The trunks of the birches looked like narrow ghosts. Barbie felt as if they were driving into a noir movie from the late 1940s. "Stop, stop, stop," he said. "This is as close as you want to go. Looks like there's nothing there, but take my word for it, there is. It would likely blow the electronics in your little car, if nothing else." She stopped and they got out. For a moment, they just stood in front of the car, squinting into the bright light. Julia raised one hand to shield her eyes. Parked beyond the lights, nose to nose, were two brown canvas-back military trucks. Sawhorses had been placed on the road for good measure, their feet braced with sandbags. Motors roared steadily in the darkness, not one generator but several. Barbie saw thick electrical cables snaking away from the spotlights and into the woods, where other lights glared through the trees. "They're going to light the perimeter," he said, and twirled one finger in the air like an ump, signaling a home run. Lights around the whole town, shining in and shining up.
"Why up?"
"The up ones to warn away air traffic. If any gets through, that is. I'd guess it's mostly tonight they're worried about. By tomorrow they'll have the airspace over the mill sewn up like one of Uncle Scrooge's money bags." On the dark side of the spotlights, but visible in their backsplash, were half a dozen armed soldiers, standing at parade rest with their backs turned. They must have heard the approach of the car, quiet as it was, but not one of them so much as looked around. Julia called, "Hello, fellas." No one turned. Barbie didn't expect it. On their way out, Julia had told Barbie what Cox had told her, but he had to try, and because he could read their insignia, he knew what to try. The army might be running this show. Cox's involvement suggested that, but these fellows weren't army. "Yo, Marines," he called. Nothing. Barbie stepped closer. He saw a dark horizontal line hanging on the air above the road, but ignored it for the time being. He was more interested in the men guarding the barrier, or the dome. Shumway had said Cox called it the dome. "I'm surprised to see you force recon boys stateside," he said, walking a little closer. "That little Afghanistan problem over, is it?" Nothing. He walked closer. The grit of the hardpan under his shoes seemed very loud. "A remarkably high number of pussies in Force Recon, or so I've heard. I'm relieved, actually. If this situation was really bad, they would have sent in the Rangers."
"Pokey bait,"
one of them muttered. It wasn't much, but Barbie was encouraged. "Stand easy, fellas. Stand easy and let's talk this over." More nothing. And he was as close to the barrier, or the dome, as he wanted to go. His skin didn't rash out in goosebumps, and the hair on his neck didn't try to stand up, but he knew the thing was there. He sensed it, and could see it, that stripe hanging on the air. He didn't know what color it would be in daylight, but he was guessing red, the color of danger. It was spray paint, and he would have bet the entire contents of his bank account, currently just over $5,000, that it went all the way around the barrier. "Like a stripe on a shirt sleeve," he thought. He balled a fist and rapped on his side of the stripe, once more producing that knuckles-on-glass sound. One of the Marines jumped. Julia began, "I'm not sure that's a good..." Barbie ignored her. He was starting to be angry. Part of him had been waiting to be angry all day, and here was his chance. He knew it would do no good to go off on these guys. They were only spear carriers, but it was hard to bite back. "Yo, Marines, help a brother out."
"Quit it, pal."
Although the speaker didn't turn around, Barbie knew it was the CO of this happy little band. He recognized the tone, had used it himself, many times. We've got our orders, so you help a brother out. Another time, another place, I'd be happy to buy you a beer or kick your ass, but not here, not tonight, so what do you say?
I say okay, Barbie said. But seeing as how we're all on the same side, I don't have to like it.
He turned to Julia. Got your phone? She held it up.
You should get one, they're the coming thing.
I have one, Barbie said. A disposable Best Buy special. Hardly ever use it. Left it in a drawer when I tried to blow town. Saw no reason not to leave it there tonight. She handed him hers.
You'll have to punch the number, I'm afraid. I've got work to do.
She raised her voice so the soldiers standing beyond the glaring lights could hear her. I'm the editor of the local newspaper, after all, and I want to get some pics. She raised her voice a little more. Especially a few of soldiers standing with their backs turned on a town that's in trouble.
Ma'am, I kind of wish you wouldn't do that, the CO said. He was a blocky fellow with a broad back.
Stop me, she invited.
I think you know we can't do that, he said. As far as our backs being turned, those are our orders.
Marine, she said, you take your orders, roll them tight, bend over, and stick them where the air quality is questionable. In the brilliant light, Barbie saw a remarkable thing, her mouth set in a harsh, unforgiving line, and her eyes streaming tears. While Barbie dialed the number with the weird area code, she got her camera and began snapping. The flash wasn't very bright, compared to the big generator-driven spotlights, but Barbie saw the soldiers flinch every time it went off. Probably hoping their fucking insignia doesn't show, he thought. 2. United States Army Colonel James O. Cox had said he'd be sitting with a hand on the phone at 10:30. Barbie and Julia Shumway had run a little late, and Barbie didn't place the call until 20 of 11, but Cox's hand must have stayed right there, because the phone only managed half a ring before Barbie's old boss said, "Hello, this is Ken." Barbie was still mad, but laughed just the same. "Yes, sir, and I continue to be the bitch who gets all the good shit." Cox also laughed, no doubt thinking they were off to a good start. "How are you, Captain Barbara?"
"Sir, I'm fine, sir, but with respect, it's just Dale Barbara now. The only things I captain these days are the grills and fryolators in the local restaurant, and I'm in no mood for small talk. I am perplexed, sir, and since I'm looking at the backs of a bunch of pogey bait Marines who won't turn around and look me in the eye, I'm also pretty goddamn pissed off." "Understood. And you need to understand something from my end. If there was anything at all those men could do to aid or end this situation, you would be looking at their faces instead of their asses. Do you believe that?"
"I'm hearing you, sir." Which wasn't exactly an answer. Julia was still snapping. Barbie shifted to the edge of the road. From his new position, he could see a bivouac tent beyond the trucks. Also, what might have been a small mess tent, plus a parking area filled with more trucks. The Marines were building a camp here, and probably bigger ones where Route 119 and 117 left town. That suggested permanence. His heart sank.
"Is the newspaper woman there?" Cox asked.
"She's here, taking pictures. And, sir, full disclosure, whatever you tell me, I tell her. I'm on this side now." Julia stopped what she was doing long enough to flash Barbie a smile.
"Understood, Captain."
"Sir, calling me that earns you no points."
"All right, just Barbie. Is that better?"
"Yes, sir."
"As to how much the lady decides to publish, for the sake of the people in that little town of yours, I hope she's got sense enough to pick and choose."
"My guess is she does."
"And if she emails pictures to anyone on the outside, one of the news magazines or the New York Times, for instance, you may find your internet goes the way of your landlines."
"Sir, that's some dirty shit."
"The decision would be made above my pay grade. I'm just saying."
Barbie sighed. "I'll tell her." "Tell me what?" Julia asked.
"That if you try to transmit those pictures, they may take it out on the town by shutting down internet access." Julia made a hand gesture Barbie did not ordinarily associate with pretty Republican ladies. He returned his attention to the phone.
"How much can you tell me?"
"Everything I know," Cox said.
"Thank you, sir."
Although Barbie doubted Cox would actually spill everything.
The army never told everything it knew. Or thought it knew. We're calling it the Dome, Cox said. But it's not a dome. At least we don't think it is. We think it's a capsule, whose edges conform exactly to the borders of the town. And I do mean exactly.
Do you know how high it goes?
It appears to top out at 47,000 and change. We don't know if the top is flat or rounded. At least not yet.
Barbie said nothing. He was flabbergasted.
As to how deep, who knows? All we can say now is more than 100 feet. That's the current depth of an excavation we're making on the border between Chester's Mill and the unincorporated township to the north.
TR-90.
To Barbie's ears, his voice sounded dull and listless. Whatever. We started in a gravel pit that was already dug down to 40 feet or so. I've seen spectrographic images that blow my mind. Long sheets of metamorphic rock that have been sheared in two. There's no gap, but you can see a shift where the northern part of the sheet dropped a little. We've checked seismographic reports from the Portland Meteorological Station, and bingo, there was a bump at 11:44 a.m., 2.1 on the Richter. So, that's when it happened.
Great, Barbie said.
He supposed he was being sarcastic, but he was too amazed and perplexed to be sure. None of this is conclusive, but it's persuasive. Of course, the exploring has just started, but right now it does look as if the thing is down as well as up. And if it goes up 5 miles...
How do you know that? Radar?
Negative. This thing doesn't show on radar. There's no way of telling it's there until you hit it. Or until you're so close you can't stop. The human toll when the thing went up was remarkably low, but you've got one hell of a bird kill around the edges. Inside and outside.
I know, I've seen them.
Julia was done with her pictures now. She was standing next to him listening to Barbie's end of the conversation.
So, how do you know how high it is? Lasers?
No, they also shoot right through. We've been using missiles with dummy warheads. We've been flying F-15A sorties out of Bangor since 4 this afternoon. Surprised you didn't hear them.
I might have heard something, Barbie said, but my mind was occupied with other things.
Like the airplane, and the pulp truck, the dead people out on Route 117, part of the remarkably low human toll. They kept bouncing off. And then at 47,000 plus, just zippity-zoom, up, up and away. Between you and me, I'm surprised we didn't lose any of those fighter jocks.
Have you actually overflown it yet?
Less than 2 hours ago. Mission successful.
Who did it, Colonel?
We don't know. Was it us? Is this an experiment that went wrong? Or, God help us, some kind of test? You owe me the truth. You owe this town the truth. These people are goddamn terrified. Understood. But it wasn't us.
Would you know if it was?
Cox hesitated. When he next spoke, his voice was lower. We have good sources in my department. When they fart in the NSA, we hear it. The same is true about Group 9 at Langley, and a couple of other little deals you never heard of.
It was possible that Cox was telling the truth, and it was possible he wasn't. He was a creature of his calling, after all. If he had been drawing sentry duty out here in the chilly autumn dark with the rest of the Pogie Bait Marines, Cox, too, would have been standing with his back turned.
He wouldn't have liked it, but orders were orders.
Any chance it's some sort of natural phenomenon? Barbie asked.
One that conforms exactly to the man-made borders of a whole town, every nook and fucking cranny, what do you think?
I had to ask, is it permeable, do you know?
Water goes through, Cox said. A little, anyway.
How is that possible?
Although he'd seen for himself the weird way water behaved, both he and Gendron had seen it. We don't know. How could we?
Cox sounded exasperated.
We've been working on this less than 12 hours. People here are slapping themselves on the back just for figuring out how high it goes. We may figure it out, but for now, we just don't know.
Air?
Air goes through to a greater degree. We've set up a monitoring station where your town borders on...
Faintly, Barbie heard paper rustle.
Harlow. They've done what they call puff tests. I guess that must measure outgoing air pressure against what bounces back. Anyway, air goes through, and a lot more freely than water does, but the scientists say still, not completely. This is going to severely fuck up your weather, pal, but nobody can say how much or how bad. Hell, maybe it'll turn Chester's Mill into Palm Springs. He laughed rather feebly. Particulates? Barbie thought he knew the answer to that one.
Nope,
Cox said. Particulate matter doesn't go through, at least we don't think so, and you want to be aware that works both ways. If particulate matter doesn't get in, it won't get out. That means auto emissions.
Nobody's got that far to drive. Chester's Mill is maybe 4 miles across at its widest, along a diagonal.
He looked at Julia.
7 tops, she said.
Cox said, we don't think oil heat pollutants are going to be a big deal either. I'm sure everybody in town has a nice expensive oil furnace. In Saudi Arabia, they have bumper stickers on their cars these days saying, I heart New England. But modern oil furnaces need electricity to provide a constant spark. Your oil reserves are probably good, considering the home heating season hasn't started yet, but we don't think it's going to be very useful to you. In the long run, that may be a good thing, from the pollution standpoint.
You think so? Come on up here when it's 30 below zero and the wind's blowing it. He stopped for a moment. Will the wind blow?
We don't know, Cox said. Ask me tomorrow and I may at least have a theory.
We can burn wood, Julia said. Tell him that. Miss Shumway says we can burn wood.
People have to be careful about that, Captain Barbara. Barbie. Sure, you've got plenty of wood up there, and you don't need electricity to ignite it and keep it going, but wood produces ash. Hell, it produces carcinogens.
Heating season here starts... Barbie looked at Julia. November 15th, she said, or thereabouts. Miss Shumway says mid-November, so tell me you're going to have this worked out by then.
All I can say is that we intend to try like hell. Which brings me to the point of this conversation. The smart boys, the ones we've been able to convene so far, all agree that we're dealing with a force field.
Just like on Star Trek, Barbie said. Beam me up, Snotty.
Beg your pardon?
Doesn't matter. Go on, sir.
They all agree that a force field doesn't just happen. Something either close to the field of effect or in the center of it has to generate it. Our guys think the center is most likely. Like the handle of an umbrella, one of them said.
You think this is an inside job?
We think it's a possibility. And we just happen to have a decorated soldier in town.
Ex-soldier, Barbie thought. And the decorations went into the Gulf of Mexico 18 months ago. But he had an idea his term of service had just been extended, like it or not. Held over by popular demand, as the saying went.
Whose specialty in Iraq was hunting down Al-Qaeda bomb factories. Hunting them down and shutting them down.
So, basically just another Jenny. He thought of all those he and Julia Shumway had passed on the way out here, roaring away in the dark, providing heat and light, eating propane to do it. He realized that propane and storage batteries, even more than food, had become the new gold standard in Chester's Mill. One thing he knew, people would burn wood. If it got cold and the propane was gone, they'd burn plenty. Hardwood, softwood, trashwood. And fuck the carcinogens.
It won't be like the generators working away in your part of the world tonight, Cox said. A thing that could do this, we don't know what it would be like, or who could build such a thing.
But Uncle Sammy wants it, Barbie said. He was gripping the phone almost tightly enough to crack it. That's actually the priority, isn't it, sir?
Because a thing like that could change the world. The people of this town are strictly secondary.
Collateral damage, in fact.
Oh, let's not be melodramatic, Cox said. In this matter, our interests coincide. Find the generator if it's there to be found. Find it the way you found those bomb factories and then shut it down. Problem solved.
If it's there.
If it's there, roger that. Will you try?
Do I have a choice?
Not that I can see, but I'm career military. For us, free will isn't an option.
Ken, this is one fucked up fire drill.
Cox was slow to reply. Although there was silence on the line,
except for a faint high hum that might mean the proceedings were being recorded. Barbie could almost hear him reflecting. Then he said,
"That's true, but you still get all the good shit, you bitch."
Barbie laughed. He couldn't help it. 3. On the way back, passing the dark shape that was Christ the Holy Redeemer Church, he turned to Julia. In the glow of the dashboard lights, her face looked tired and solemn. "I won't tell you to keep quiet about any of this," he said, "but I think you should hold one thing back. The generator that may or may not be in town." She took a hand off the wheel, reached back, and stroked Horace's head, as if for comfort and reassurance. "Yes. Because if there's a generator spinning the field, creating your colonel's dome, then somebody must be running it. Somebody here." Cox didn't say that, but I'm sure it's what he thinks. "I'll withhold that, and I won't email any pictures."
"Good.
They should run first in the Democrat anyway, damn it." Julia continued stroking the dog. People who drove one-handed usually made Barbie nervous, but not tonight. They both had Little Bitch and 119 to themselves. "Also, I understand that sometimes the greater good is more important than a great story, unlike the New York Times."
"Zing," Barbie said.
"And if you find the generator, I won't have to spend too many days shopping at Food City. I hate that place." She looked startled. "Do you think it'll even be open tomorrow?"
"I'd say yes. People can be slow to catch up with the new deal when the old deal changes."
"I think I better do a little Sunday shopping," she said thoughtfully.
"When you do, say hello to Rose Twitchell. She'll probably have the faithful Anson Wheeler with her." Remembering his earlier advice to Rose, he laughed and said, "Meet, meet, meet."
"Beg your pardon?"
"If you have a generator at your house."
"Of course I do. I live over the newspaper, not a house, a very nice apartment. The generator was a tax deduction."
She said this proudly.
"Then buy meat. Meat and canned goods. Canned goods and meat."
She thought about it. Downtown was just ahead now. There were far fewer lights than usual, but still plenty.
For how long? Barbie wondered.
Then Julia asked,
"Did your colonel give you any ideas about how to find this generator?"
"Nope," Barbie said. "Finding shit used to be my job. He knows that."
He paused, then asked, "Do you think there might be a Geiger counter in town?" "I know there is, in the basement of the town hall. Actually, the sub-basement, I guess you'd say. There's a fallout shelter there."
"You're shitting me," she laughed.
"No shit, Sherlock. I did a feature story on it 3 years ago. Pete Freeman took the pictures. In the basement, there's a big conference room and a little kitchen. The shelter's half a flight of stairs down from the kitchen. Pretty good sized. It was built in the 50s, when the smart money was on us blowing ourselves to hell."
"On the beach," Barbie said.
"Yep, see that and raise you, alas, Babylon. It's a pretty depressing place. Pete's pictures reminded me of the Fuhrer bunker, just before the end. There's a kind of pantry, shelves and shelves of canned goods, and half a dozen cots. Also some equipment supplied by the government, including a Geiger counter."
"The canned stuff must be extremely tasty after 50 years.
"Actually, they rotate in new goods every so often. There's even a small generator that went in after 9/11. Check the town report, and you'll see an appropriation item for the shelter every 4 years or so. Used to be $300, now it's $600. You've got your Geiger counter." She shifted her eyes to him briefly. "Of course, James Rennie sees all things town hall, from the attic to the fallout shelter, as his personal property. So he'll want to know why you want it."
"Big Jim Rennie isn't going to know," he said.
She accepted this without comment. "Would you like to come back to the office with me? Watch the president's speech while I start comping the paper? It'll be a quick and dirty job, I can tell you that. One story, half a dozen pictures for local consumption. No Burpee's Autumn Sales Day circular."
Barbie considered it. He was going to be busy tomorrow, not just cooking, but asking questions. Starting the old job, all over again, in the old way. On the other hand, if he went back to his place over the drugstore, would he be able to sleep?
"Okay. And I probably shouldn't be telling you this, but I have excellent office boy skills. I also make a mean cup of coffee.
Mister, you are on. She raised her right hand off the wheel and Barbie slapped her five.
Can I ask you one more question, strictly not for publication?
Sure, he said.
This sci-fi generator, do you think you'll find it?
Barbie thought it over as she pulled in beside the storefront that housed the Democrats' offices.
No, he said at last. That would be too easy.
She sighed and nodded. Then she grasped his fingers.
Would it help, do you think, if I prayed for your success?
Couldn't hurt, Barbie said. 4. There were only two churches in Chester's Mill on Dome Day. Both pervade the Protestant brand of goods, although in very different ways. Catholics went to Our Lady of Serene Waters in Motton, and the town's dozen or so Jews attended Congregation Beth Shalom in Castle Rock when they felt in need of spiritual consolation. Once there'd been a Unitarian church, but it had died of neglect in the late 80s. Everyone agreed it had been sort of hippy-dippy anyway. The building now housed Mill new and used books. Both Chester's Mill pastors were what Big Jim Rennie liked to call knee-bound that night, but their modes of address, states of mind, and expectations were very different. The Reverend Piper Libby, who ministered to her flock from the pulpit of the First Congregational Church, no longer believed in God, although this was a fact she had not shared with her congregants. Lester Coggins, on the other hand, believed to the point of martyrdom, or madness. Both words were the same thing, perhaps. The Rev. Libby, still wearing her Saturday grubs, and still pretty enough, even at 45, to look good in them, knelt in front of the altar in almost total darkness. The Congo had no generator, with Clover, her German shepherd, lying behind her with his nose on his paws and his eyes at half-mast.
"Hello, Not There," Piper said.
Not There was her private name for God just lately. Earlier in the fall, it had been the Great Maybe. During the summer, it had been the Omnipotent Could Be. She'd liked that one. It had a certain ring.
"You know the situation I've been in. You should. I've bent your ear about it enough. But that's not what I'm here to talk about tonight, which is probably a relief to you."
She sighed.
"We're in a mess here, my friend. I hope you understand it, because I sure don't. But we both know this place is going to be full of people tomorrow, looking for heavenly disaster assistance."
It was quiet inside the church. Quiet outside, too. Too quiet, as they said in the old movies. Had she ever heard the mill this quiet on a Saturday night? There was no traffic, and the bass thump of whatever weekend band happened to be playing at Dippers, always advertised as being direct from Boston, was absent.
"I'm not going to ask that you show me your will, because I'm no longer convinced you actually have a will. But on the off chance that you are there, after all, always a possibility, I'm more than happy to admit that. Please help me to say something helpful. Hope not in heaven, but right here on earth, because..."
She was not surprised to find that she had started to cry. She bawled so often now, although always in private. New Englanders strongly disapproved of public tears from ministers and politicians. Clover, sensing her distress, whined. Piper told him to hush, then turned back to the altar. She often thought of the cross there as the religious version of the Chevrolet bow tie, a logo that had come into being for no other reason than because some guy saw it on the wallpaper of a Paris hotel room 100 years ago and liked it. If you saw such symbols as divine, you were probably a lunatic. Nevertheless, she persevered.
"Because, as I'm sure you know, Earth is what we have, what we're sure of. I want to help my people, that's my job, and I still want to do it. Assuming you're there and that you care, shaky assumptions, I admit, then please help me. Amen."
She stood up. She had no flashlight, but anticipated no trouble finding her way outside with unbarked shins. She knew this place step for step and obstacle for obstacle. Loved it, too. She didn't fool herself about either her lack of faith or her stubborn love of the idea itself.
"Come on, Clove," she said. "President in half an hour.
the other great not there. We can listen on the car radio.
Clover followed placidly, untroubled by questions of faith. 5. Out on Little Bitch Road, always referred to as Number 3 by Holy Redeemer worshippers, a far more dynamic scene was taking place, and under bright electric lights. Lester Coggins's house of worship possessed a generator new enough for the shipping tags still to be pasted on its bright orange side. It had its own shed, also painted orange, next to the storage barn behind the church. Lester was a man of 50, so well-maintained, by genetics as well as his own strenuous efforts to take care of the temple of his body, that he looked no more than 35. Judicious applications of Just for Men helped in this regard. He wore nothing tonight but a pair of gym shorts, with Oral Roberts' golden eagles printed on the right leg, and almost every muscle on his body stood out. During services, of which there were 5 each week, Lester prayed in an ecstatic televangelist tremolo, turning the big fellow's name into something that sounded as if it could have come from an overamped wah-wah pedal. Not God, but God. In his private prayers, he sometimes fell into these same cadences without realizing it. But when he was deeply troubled, when he really needed to take counsel with the God of Moses and Abraham, he who traveled as a pillar of smoke by day and a pillar of fire by night, Lester held up his end of the conversation in a deep growl, then made him sound like a dog on the verge of attacking an intruder. He wasn't aware of this because there was no one in his life to hear him pray. Piper Libby was a widow who had lost her husband and both young sons in an accident 3 years before. Lester Coggins was a lifelong bachelor who, as an adolescent, had suffered nightmares of masturbating and looking up to see Mary Magdalene standing in his bedroom doorway. The church was almost as new as the generator and constructed of expensive red maple. It was also plain to the point of starkness. Behind Lester's bare back stretched a triple rank of pews beneath a beamed ceiling. Ahead of him was the pulpit, nothing but a lectern with a Bible on it and a large redwood cross hanging on a drape of royal purple. The choir loft was above and to the right with musical instruments, including the Stratocaster Lester himself sometimes played, clustered at one end.
God, hear my prayer, Lester said in his growly, I'm really praying voice.
In one hand he held a heavy length of rope that had been knotted 12 times, one knot for each disciple. The 9th knot, the one signifying Judas, had been painted black.
God, hear my prayer. I ask it in the name of the crucified and risen Jesus.
He began to whip himself across the back with the rope, first over the left shoulder and then over the right, his arm rising and flexing smoothly. His not inconsiderable biceps and delts began to pop a sweat. When it struck his already well-scarred skin, the knotted rope made a carpet-beater sound. He had done this many times before, but never with such force.
God, hear my prayer! God, hear my prayer! God, hear my prayer! God, hear my prayer! Whack and whack and whack and whack, the sting like fire like nettles, sinking in along the turnpikes and byroads of his miserable human nerves, both terrible and terribly satisfying. Lord, we have sinned in this town, and I am chief among sinners. I listened to Jim Rennie and believed his lies. Yea, I believed, and here is the price. And it is now as it was of old. It's not just the one that pays for the sin of one, but the many. You are slow to anger, but when it comes, your anger is like the storms that sweep a field of wheat, laying low not just one stock or a score, but every one. I have sowed the wind and reaped the whirlwind, not just for one, but for many.
There were other sins and other sinners in the mill. He knew that. He was not naive. They swore and danced and sexed and took drugs he knew far too much about. And they no doubt deserved to be punished, to be scourged. But that was true of every town, surely, and this was the only one that had been singled out for this terrible act of God. And yet, was it possible that this strange curse was not because of his sin? Yes, possible.
although not likely.
Lord, I need to know what to do. I'm at the crossroads. If it's your will that I should stand in this pulpit tomorrow morning and confess to what that man talked me into, the sins we participated in together, the sins I have participated in alone, then I will do so. But that would mean the end of my ministry, and it's hard for me to believe that's your will at such a crucial time. If it's your will that I should wait, wait and see what happens next. Wait and pray with my flock that this burden should be lifted, then I'll do that. Your will be done, Lord, now and always.
He paused in his scourging. He could feel warm and comforting trickles running down his bare back. Several of the rope knots had begun to turn red, and turned his tear-stained face up toward the beamed roof.
Because these folks need me, Lord. You know they do, now more than ever. So, if it's your will that this cup should be removed from my lips, please, give me a sign.
He waited. And behold, the Lord God said unto Lester Coggins,
I will shew you a sign. Goest thou to thy Bible, even as you did as a child after those nasty dreams of yours.
This minute, Lester said, this second.
He hung the knotted rope around his neck, where it printed a blood horseshoe on his chest and shoulders, then mounted to the pulpit with more blood trickling down the hollow of his spine and dampening the elastic waistband of his shorts. He stood at the pulpit as if to preach, although never in his worst nightmares had he dreamed of preaching in such scant garb. Closed the Bible, lying open there, then shut his eyes.
Lord, thy will be done. I ask in the name of your Son, crucified in shame and risen in glory.
And the Lord said,
open my book and see what you see.
Lester did as instructed, taking care not to open the big Bible too close to the middle. This was an Old Testament job, if ever there had been one. He plunged his finger down to the unseen page, then opened his eyes and bent to look. It was the second chapter of Deuteronomy, the 28th verse. He read, the Lord shall smite thee with madness and blindness and astonishment of the heart. Astonishment of the heart was probably good, but on the whole this wasn't encouraging or clear. Then the Lord spake again, saying,
don't stop there, Lester.
He read the 29th verse. And thou shalt grope at noonday.
Yes, Lord, yes,
he breathed, and read on. As the blind gropeth in darkness, and thou shalt not prosper in thy ways, and thou shalt be only oppressed and spoiled evermore, and no man shall save thee.
Will I be struck blind?
Lester asked, his growly prayer voice rising slightly. Oh, God, please don't do that, although,
if it is thy will.
The Lord spake unto him again, saying,
did you get up on the stupid side of the bed today, Lester?
His eyes flew wide. God's voice, but one of his mother's favorite sayings, a true miracle.
No, Lord, no.
Then look again. What am I shewing you?
It's something about madness or blindness.
Which of the two dost thou thinkest most likely?
Lester scored the verses. The only word repeated was blind.
Is that, Lord, is that my sign?
The Lord answered, saying,
yea, verily, but not thine own blindness, for now thine eyes see more clearly. Lookest thou for the blinded one who has gone mad? When you see him, you must tell your congregation what Rennie has been up to out here, and your part in it. You both must tell. We'll talk about this more, but for now, Lester, go to bed. You're dripping on the floor.
Lester did, but first he cleaned up the little splatters of blood on the hardwood behind the pulpit. He did it on his knees. He didn't pray as he worked, but he meditated on the verses. He felt much better. For the time being, he would speak only generally of the sins which might have brought this unknown barrier down between the mill and the outside world, but he would look for the sign. For a blind man or woman who had gone crazy, yea, verily.
6. Brenda Perkins listened to WCIK because her husband liked it. Had liked it. But she would never have set foot inside the Holy Redeemer Church. She was Congo to the core. And she made sure her husband went with her. Had made sure. Howie would only be in the Congo church once more. Would lie there, unknowing, while Piper Libby preached his eulogy. This realization, so stark and immutable, struck home. For the first time since she'd gotten the news, Brenda let loose and wailed. Perhaps because now she could. Now, she was alone. On the television, the president, looking solemn and frighteningly old, was saying, "My fellow Americans, you want answers, and I pledge to give them to you as soon as I have them. There will be no secrecy on this issue. My window on events will be your window. That is my solemn promise."
"Yeah, and you've got a bridge you want to sell me," Brenda said, and that made her cry harder because it was one of Howie's faves.
She snapped off the TV, then dropped the remote on the floor. She felt like stepping on it and breaking it, but didn't, mostly because she could see Howie shaking his head and telling her not to be silly. She went into his little study instead, wanting to touch him somehow while his presence here was still fresh, needing to touch him. Out back, their generator purred. Fat and happy, Howie would have said. She'd hated the expense of that thing when Howie ordered it after 9/11. Just to be on the safe side, he'd told her. But now she regretted every sniping word she'd said about it. Missing him in the dark would have been even more terrible, more lonely. His desk was bare, except for his laptop, which was standing open. His screensaver was a picture from a long-ago Little League game. Both Howie and Chip, then 11 or 12, were wearing the green jerseys of the Sanders hometown drug monarchs. The picture had been taken the year Howie and Rusty Everett had taken the Sanders team to the state finals. Chip had his arms around his father, and Brenda had her arms around both of them. A good day, but fragile. As fragile as a crystal goblet. Who knew such things at the time, when it still might be possible to hold on a little? She hadn't been able to get hold of Chip yet, and the thought of that call, supposing she could make it, undid her completely. Sobbing, she got down on her knees beside her husband's desk. She didn't fold her hands, but put them together palm to palm, as she had as a child, kneeling in flannel pajamas beside her bed and reciting the mantra of "God bless Mom, God bless Dad, God bless my goldfish who doesn't have a name yet." "God, this is Brenda. I don't want him back. Well, I do, but I know you can't do that. Only give me the strength to bear this, okay? And I wonder if maybe, I don't know if this is blasphemy or not, probably it is, but I wonder if you could let him talk to me one more time. Maybe let him touch me one more time like he did this morning." At the thought of it, his fingers on her skin in the sunshine, she cried even harder.
"I know you don't deal in ghosts, except of course for the Holy One. But maybe in a dream. I know it's a lot to ask, but, oh God, there's such a hole in me tonight. I didn't know there could be such holes in a person, and I'm afraid I'll fall in. If you do this for me, I'll do something for you. All you have to do is ask. Please, God, just a touch, or a word, even if it's in a dream."
She took a deep, wet breath.
"Thank you. That will be done, of course, whether I like it or not."
She laughed weakly.
"Amen."
She opened her eyes and got up, holding the desk for support. One hand nudged the computer and the screen brightened at once. He was always forgetting to turn it off. But at least he kept it plugged in so the battery wouldn't run down. And he kept his electronic desktop far neater than she did. Hers was always cluttered with downloads and electronic sticky notes. On Howie's desktop, always just three files stacked neatly below the hard disk icon. Current, where he kept reports of ongoing investigations. Court, where he kept a list of who, including himself, was down to testify, and where, and why. The third file was Moran Street Manse, where he kept everything having to do with the house.
It occurred to her that if she opened that one, she might find something about the generator, and she needed to know about that so she could keep it running as long as possible. Henry Morrison from the PD would probably be happy to change the current propane canister, but what if there were no spares? If that were the case, she should buy more at Burpee's or the gas and grocery before they were all gone. She put her fingertip on the mouse pad, then paused. There was a fourth file on the screen lurking way down in the left-hand corner. She had never seen it before. Brenda tried to remember the last time she'd happened to look at the desktop of this computer and couldn't. Vader, the file name read. Well, there was only one person in town Howie referred to as Vader, as in Darth. Big Jim Rennie. Curious, she moved the cursor to the file and double-clicked it, wondering if it was password-protected. It was. She tried Wildcats, which opened his current file. He hadn't bothered to protect Court. And it worked. In the file were two documents. One was labeled Ongoing Investigation. The other was a PDF doc titled Letter from SMAG. In Howie speak, that stood for State of Maine Attorney General. She clicked on it. Brenda scanned the AG's letter with growing amazement as the tears dried on her cheeks. The first thing her eye happened on was the salutation. Not Dear Chief Perkins, but Dear Duke. Although the letter was couched in lawyer speak rather than Howie speak, certain phrases leaped out at her as if in bold-faced type. Misappropriation of town goods and services was the first. Selectman Sanders' involvement seems all but certain was the next. Then, this malfeasance is wider and deeper than we could have imagined 3 months ago. And near the bottom, seeming not just in boldface, but in capital letters, manufacture and sale of illegal drugs. It appeared that her prayer had been answered, and in a completely unexpected way. Brenda sat down in Howie's chair, clicked Ongoing Investigation in the Vader file, and let her late husband talk to her. 7. The President's Speech, long on comfort, short on information, wrapped up at 12:21 a.m. Rusty Everett watched it in the third-floor lounge of the hospital, made a final check of the charts, and went home. He had ended days more tired than this during his medical career, but he had never been more disheartened or worried about the future. The house was dark. He and Linda had discussed buying a generator last year and the year before because Chester's Mills always lost its power 4 or 5 days each winter, and usually a couple of times in the summer as well. Western Maine Power was not the most reliable of service providers. The bottom line had been that they just couldn't afford it. Perhaps if Lynn went full-time with the cops, but neither of them wanted that with the girls still small. At least we got a good stove and a hell of a wood pile, if we need it. There was a flashlight in the glove compartment, but when he turned it on, it emitted a weak beam for 5 seconds and then died. Rusty muttered an obscenity and reminded himself to stock up on batteries tomorrow, later today, now, assuming the stores were open. If I can't find my way around here after 12 years, I'm a monkey. Yes, well, he felt a little like a monkey tonight. One fresh caught and slammed into a zoo cage. And he definitely smelled like one. Maybe a shower before bed. But nope. No power, no shower. It was a clear night. And although there was no moon, there were a billion stars above the house. And they looked the same as ever. Maybe the barrier didn't exist overhead. The president hadn't spoken to that issue, so perhaps the people in charge of investigating didn't know yet. If the mill were at the bottom of a newly created well instead of caught underneath some weird bell jar, then things might still work out. The government could airdrop supplies. Surely if the country could spend hundreds of billions for corporate bailouts, then it could afford to parachute in extra Pop-Tarts and a few lousy generators. He mounted the porch steps, taking out his house key, but when he got to the door, he saw something hanging over the lock plate. He bent closer, squinting, and smiled. It was a mini flashlight. At Burpee's end-of-summer blowout sale, Linda had bought 6 for $5. At the time, he'd thought it a foolish expenditure,
He even remembered thinking, women buy stuff at sales for the same reason men climb mountains, because they're there. A small metal loop stuck out on the bottom of the light. Threaded through it was a lace from one of his old tennis shoes. A note had been taped to the lace. He took it off and trained the light on it. Hello, sweet man. Hope you're okay. The two J's are finally down for the night, both worried and upset, but finally corked off. I have duty all day tomorrow, and I do mean all day, from 7 to 7, Peter Randolph says. Our new chief, groan. Marta Edmonds said she'd take the girls, so God bless Marta. Try not to wake me, although I may not be asleep. We are in for hard days, I fear, but we'll get through this. Plenty to eat in pantry, thank God. Sweetie, I know you're tired, but will you walk Audrey? She's still doing that weird whining thing of hers. Is it possible she knew this was coming? They say dogs can sense earthquakes, so maybe... Judy and Janny say they love their daddy. So do I. We'll find time to talk tomorrow, won't we? Talk and take stock. I'm a little scared. Lynn. He was scared, too, and not crazy about his wife working a 12 tomorrow when he was likely to be working a 16, or even longer. Also not crazy about Judy and Janelle spending a whole day with Marta when they were undoubtedly scared, too. But the thing he was least crazy about was having to walk their golden retriever at nearly 1 in the morning. He thought it was possible that she had sensed the advent of the barrier. He knew the dogs were sensitive to many impending phenomena, not just earthquakes. Only if that were the case... What he and Linda called the whining thing should have stopped, right? The rest of the dogs in town had been grave quiet on his way back tonight. No barking, no howling. Nor had he heard other reports of dogs doing the whining thing. Maybe she'll be asleep on her bed beside the stove, he thought, as he unlocked the kitchen door. Audrey wasn't asleep. She came to him at once, not bounding joyfully as she usually did. You're home, oh, thank God, you're home. But sidling, almost slinking, with her tail tucked down over her withers, as if expecting a blow, which she had never received, instead of a pat on the head. And yes, she was once more doing the whining thing. It had actually been going on since before the barrier. She'd stop for a couple of weeks, and Rusty would begin to hope it was over. And then it would start again, sometimes soft, sometimes loud. Tonight, it was loud. Or maybe it only seemed that way in the dark kitchen, where the digital readouts on the stove and the microwave were out, and the usual light Linda left on for him over the sink was dark. "Stop it, girl," he said. "You'll wake the house." But Audrey wouldn't. She butted her head softly against his knee and looked up at him in the bright, narrow beam of light he held in his right hand. He would have sworn that was a pleading look. "All right," he said. "All right, all right. Walkies." Her leash dangled from a peg beside the pantry door. As he went to get it, dropping the light around his neck to hang by the shoelace as he did, she skittered in front of him, more like a cat than a dog. If not for the flashlight, she might have tripped him up. That would have finished this whore of a day in grand fashion. Just a minute, hold on. But she barked at him and backed away. Hush, Audrey, hush! Instead of hushing, she barked again, the sound shockingly loud in the sleeping house. He jerked in surprise. Audrey darted forward and seized the leg of his pants in her teeth and began to back toward the hall, trying to pull him along. Now, intrigued, Rusty allowed himself to be led. When she saw he was coming, Audrey let go and ran to the stairs. She went up too, looked back, and barked again. A light went on upstairs in their bedroom.
Rusty...
It was Lynn, her voice muzzy.
"Yeah, it's me," he called, keeping it as low as he could. "Actually, it's Audrey."
He followed the dog up the stairs. Instead of taking them at her usual all-out lope, Audrey kept pausing to look back. To dog people, their animals' expressions are often perfectly readable. And what Rusty was seeing now was anxiety. Audrey's ears were laid flat, her tail still tucked. If this was the whining thing, it had been raised to a new level. Rusty suddenly wondered if there was a prowler in the house. The kitchen door had been locked. Lynn was usually good about locking all the doors when she was alone with the girls, but... Linda came to the head of the stairs, belting a white terry cloth robe. Audrey saw her and barked again. A get out of my way bark.
Audie, st-
stop that,
she said. But Audrey ran past her, striking against Lynn's right leg hard enough to knock her back against the wall. Then the Golden ran down the hall towards the girls' room, where all was still quiet. Lynn fished her own mini flashlight from a pocket of her robe.
What in the name of heaven?
Well, I think you better go back to the bedroom, Rusty said.
Like hell I will.
She ran down the hall ahead of him, the bright beam of the little light bouncing. The girls were 7 and 5, and had recently entered what Lynn called the feminine privacy phase. Audrey reached their door, rose up, and began scratching on it with her front paws. Rusty caught up with Lynn just as she opened the door. Audrey bounded in, not even giving Judy's bed a look. Their 5-year-old was fast asleep anyway. Janelle wasn't asleep, nor was she awake. Rusty understood everything the moment the 2 flashlight beams converged on her, and cursed himself for not realizing earlier what was happening, what must have been happening since August, or maybe even July. Because the behavior Audrey had been exhibiting, the whining thing, was well documented. He just hadn't seen the truth when it was staring him in the face. Janelle, eyes open but showing only whites, wasn't convulsing, thank God for that, but she was trembling all over. She had pushed the covers down with her feet, probably at onset, and in the double flashlight beams he could see a damp patch on her pajama bottoms. Her fingertips wiggled, as if she were loosening up to play the piano. Audrey sat by the bed, looking up at her little mistress with rapt attention.
What's happening to her?
Linda screamed. In the other bed, Judy stirred and spoke.
Mama, is it breakfast? Did I miss the bus?
She's having a seizure, Rusty said.
Well, help her, Linda cried. Do something! Is she dying?
No, Rusty said. The part of his brain that remained analytical knew this was almost certainly just petty mal, as the others must have been, or they would have known about this already. But it was different when it was one of your own. Judy sat bolt upright in bed, spilling stuffed animals everywhere. Her eyes were wide and terrified, nor was she much comforted when Linda tore the child out of bed and clasped her in her arms.
Make her stop, Rusty.
If it was petty mal, it would stop on its own.
Please, God, let it stop on its own, he thought.
He placed his palms on the sides of Jan's trembling, thrumming head, and tried to rotate it upward, wanting to make sure her airway remained clear. At first he wasn't able to. The goddamn foam pillow was fighting him. He tossed it on the floor. It struck Audrey on the way down, but she didn't so much as flinch, only maintained her rapt gaze. Rusty was now able to cock Janny's head back a little, and he could hear her breathing. It wasn't rapid. There was no harsh tearing for oxygen either.
Mommy, what's the matter with Jan?
Judy asked, beginning to cry.
Is she mad? Is she sick?
Not mad, and only a little sick. Rusty was astounded at how calm he sounded. Why don't you let Mommy take you down to our...
No!
They cried together in perfect 2-part harmony. Okay, he said, but you have to be quiet. Don't scare her when she wakes up, because she's apt to be scared already. A little scared, he amended. Audie, good girl. That's a very, very good girl. Such compliments usually sent Audrey into paroxysms of joy, but not tonight. She didn't even wag her tail. Then suddenly the Golden gave a small woof and lay down, dropping her muzzle onto one paw. Seconds later, Jan's trembling ceased and her eyes closed.
I'll be damned, Rusty said. What?
Linda was now sitting on the edge of Judy's bed with Judy on her lap.
What?
It's over, Rusty said. But it wasn't. Not quite. When Jenny opened her eyes again, they were back where they belonged. But they weren't seeing him.
The great pumpkin,
Janelle cried.
It's the great pumpkin's fault. You have to stop the great pumpkin.
Rusty gave her a gentle shake. You were having a dream, Jenny, a bad one, I guess, but it's over and you're all right. For a moment, she still wasn't completely there, although her eyes shifted, and he knew she was seeing and hearing him now.
Stop Halloween, Daddy. You have to stop Halloween.
Okay, honey, I will. Halloween's off completely. She blinked, then raised one hand to brush her clumped and sweaty hair off her forehead.
What?
Why, I was going to be Princess Leia. Does everything have to go wrong with my life?
She began to cry. Linda came over, Judy scurrying behind and holding onto the skirt of her mother's robe, and took Janelle in her arms.
You can still be Princess Leia, honey love, I promise.
Jan was looking at her parents with puzzlement, suspicion, and growing fright.
What are you doing in here, and why is she up?
Pointing to Judy.
You peed your bed,
Judy said smugly, and when Jan realized and started to cry harder, Rusty felt like smacking Judy a good one. He usually felt like a pretty enlightened parent, especially compared to those he sometimes saw creeping into the health center with their arm broke or eye blackened children. But not tonight. It doesn't matter, Rusty said, hugging Jan close. It wasn't your fault. You had a little problem, but it's over now.
Does she have to go to the hospital?
Linda asked. Only to the health center, and not tonight, tomorrow morning. I'll get her fixed up with the right medicine then.
No shots!
Janie screamed and began to cry harder than ever. Rusty loved the sound of it. It was a healthy sound, strong. No shots, sweetheart. Pills.
Are you sure? Lynn asked.
Rusty looked at their dog, now lying peacefully with her snout on her paw, oblivious of all the drama. Audrey, sure, he said. But she ought to sleep in here with the girls for tonight.
Yay!
Judy cried. She fell to her knees and hugged Audie extravagantly. Rusty put an arm around his wife. She laid her head on his shoulder, as if too weary to hold it up any longer.
Why now? She asked. Why now?
I don't know. Just be grateful it was only Petty Mall. On that score, his prayer had been answered. Madness, blindness, astonishment of the heart. 1. Scarecrow Joe wasn't up early. He was up late. All night, in fact. This would be Joseph McClatchy, age 13, also known as King of the Geeks and Skeletor, residing at 19 Mill Street. Standing 6'2 and weighing 150, he was indeed skeletal, and he was a bona fide brain. Joe remained in the eighth grade only because his parents were adamantly opposed to the practice of skipping forward. Joe didn't mind. His friends, he had a surprising number for a scrawny 13-year-old genius, were there. Also, the work was a tit, and there were plenty of computers to goof with. In Maine, every middle school kid got one. Some of the better websites were blocked, of course, but it hadn't taken Joe long to conquer such minor annoyances. He was happy to share the information with his homies, two of whom were those dauntless board benders Nori Calvert and Benny Drake. Benny particularly enjoyed surfing the Blondes in White Panties site during his daily library period. This sharing no doubt explained some of Joe's popularity, but not all. Kids just thought he was cool. The bumper sticker plastered on his backpack probably came closest to explaining why. It read, "Fight the powers that be." Joe was a straight-A student, a dependable and sometimes brilliant basketball center on the middle school team, varsity as a seventh grader, and a foxy good soccer player. He could tickle the piano keys, and 2 years previous had won second prize in the annual town Christmas talent competition with a hilariously laid-back dance routine to Gretchen Wilson's Redneck Woman. It had the adults in attendance applauding and screaming with laughter. Alyssa Jameson, the town's head librarian, said he could make a living doing that if he wanted to. But growing up to be Napoleon Dynamite was not Joe's ambition. The fix was in, Sam McClatchy had said, gloomily fingering his son's second-place medal. It was probably true. The winner that year had been Dougie Twitchell, who happened to be the third selectman's brother. Twitch had juggled half a dozen Indian clubs while singing Moon River. Joe didn't care if the fix was in or not. He had lost interest in dancing the way he lost interest in most things once he had to some degree mastered them. Even his love of basketball, which as a fifth grader he had assumed to be eternal, was fading. Only his passion for the internet, that electronic galaxy of endless possibilities, did not seem to pall for him. His ambition, unexpressed even to his parents, was to become President of the United States. Maybe, he sometimes thought, I'll do the Napoleon Dynamite thing at my inaugural. That shit would be on YouTube for eternity. Joe spent the entire first night the dome was in place on the internet.
The McClatchys had no generator, but Joe's laptop was juiced and ready to go. Also, he had half a dozen spare batteries. He had urged the other 7 or 8 kids in his informal computer club to also keep spares on hand, and he knew where there were more, if they were needed. They might not be. The school had a kick-ass generator, and he thought he could recharge there with no trouble. Even if Mill Middle went into lockdown, Mr. Allnut, the janitor, would no doubt hook him up. Mr. Allnut was also a fan of blondesandwhitepanties.com, not to mention country music downloads, which Scarecrow Joe saw he got for free. Joe all but wore out his Wi-Fi connection that first night, going from blog to blog with the jitter-jive agility of a toad hopping on hot rocks. Each blog was more dire than the last. The facts were thin, the conspiracy theories lush. Joe agreed with his dad and mom, who called the weirder conspiracy theorist who lived on and for the internet the tinfoil hat folks. But he was also a believer in the idea that if you were seeing a lot of horse shit, there had to be a pony in the vicinity. As Dome Day became Day 2, all the blogs were suggesting the same thing. The pony in this case was not terrorists, invaders from space, or Great Cthulhu, but the good old military-industrial complex. The specifics varied from site to site, but 3 basic theories ran through all of them. One was that the dome was some sort of heartless experiment with the people of Chester's Mill serving as guinea pigs. Another was that it was an experiment that had gone wrong and out of control. Exactly like in that movie The Mist, one blogger wrote. And third was that it wasn't an experiment at all, but a coldly created pretext to justify war with America's stated enemies. "And we'll win," Told You So 87 wrote, "because with this new weapon, who can stand against us? My friends, we have become the New England Patriots of Nations." Joe didn't know which, if any, of these theories was the truth. He didn't really care. What he cared about was the expressed common denominator, which was the government. It was time for a demonstration, which he, of course, would lead. Not in town either, but on Route 119, where they could stick it directly to the man. It might only be Joe's guys at first, but it would grow. He had no doubt of that. The man was probably still keeping the press corps away, but even at 13, Joe was wise enough to know that didn't necessarily matter, because there were people inside those uniforms and thinking brains behind at least some of those expressionless faces. The military presence as a whole might constitute the man, but there would be individuals hiding in the hole, and some of them would be secret bloggers. They'd get the word out, and some would probably accompany the reports with camera phone pictures. Joe McClatchy and his friends carrying signs reading, "End the Secrecy," "Stop the Experiment," "Free Chester's Mill," etc., etc. "Need to post signs around town, too," he murmured. But that would be no problem. All of his guys had printers. And bikes. Scarecrow Joe began sending emails by the dawn's early light. Soon he'd make the rounds on his own bike and enlist Benny Drake to help him. Maybe Nori Calvert, too. Ordinarily, the members of Joe's posse were late weekend risers, but Joe thought everyone in town would be up early this morning. No doubt, the man would shut down the internet soon, as he had the phones. But for now, it was Joe's weapon, the weapon of the people. It was time to fight the power. 2. "Fellas, raise your hands," Peter Randolph said. He was tired and baggy-eyed as he stood in front of his new recruits, but he also felt a certain grim happiness. The green chief's car was parked in the motor pool parking lot, freshly gassed and ready to go. It was his now. The new recruits, Randolph intended to call them special deputies in his formal report to the selectmen, obediently raised their hands. There were actually 5 of them, and one was not a fella, but a stocky young woman named Georgia Rue. She was an unemployed hairdresser and Carter Thibodeau's girlfriend. Junior had suggested to his father that they probably ought to add a female just to keep everybody happy, and Big Jim had concurred at once. Randolph initially resisted the idea, but when Big Jim favored the new chief with his fiercest smile, Randolph had given in. And he had to admit, as he administered the oath, with some of his regular force looking on, they certainly looked tough enough. Junior had lost some pounds over the previous summer, and was nowhere near his weight as a high school offensive lineman, but he still had to go 190,
and the others, even the girl, were authentic bruisers. They stood repeating the words after him, phrase for phrase. Junior on the far left, next to his friend Frankie de Lesseps, then Thibodeau and the Rue girl. Melvin Searles on the end. Searles was wearing a vacant going-to-the-country-fair grin. Randolph would have wiped that shit off his face in a hurry if he'd had 3 weeks to train these kids. Hell, even one. But he didn't. The only thing on which he hadn't caved to Big Jim was the issue of sidearms. Rennie had argued for them, insisting that these were level-headed, God-fearing young people, and saying he'd be glad to provide them himself if necessary. Randolph had shaken his head. The situation's too volatile. Let's see how they do first.
If one of them gets hurt while you're seeing how they do...
Nobody's going to get hurt, Big Jim, Randolph said, hoping he was right. This is Chester's Mill. If it was New York City, things might be different. 3. Now, Randolph said, and I will, to the best of my ability, protect and serve the people of this town. They gave it back as sweetly as a Sunday school class on Parents' Day. Even the vacantly grinning Searles got it right. And they look good. No guns yet. But at least they had walkie-talkies. Nightsticks, too. Stacy Moggin, who would be pulling a street shift herself, had found uniform shirts for everyone but Carter Thibodeau. They had nothing to fit him because he was too broad in the shoulders. But the plain blue work shirt he'd fetched from home looked okay. Not rag, but it was clean. And the silver badge pinned over the left pocket sent the message that needed sending. Maybe this was going to work. So help me God, Randolph said. So help me God, they repeated. From the corner of his eye, Randolph saw the door open. It was Big Jim. He joined Henry Morrison, wheezy George Frederick, Fred Denton, and a dubious-looking Jackie Weddington at the back of the room. Rennie was here to see his son sworn in, Randolph knew. And because he was still uneasy about refusing the new men's sidearms, refusing Big Jim anything ran counter to Randolph's politically attuned nature, the new chief now extemporized, mostly for the second selectman's benefit. And I will take no shit from anybody. And I will take no shit from anybody, they repeated, with enthusiasm, all smiling now, eager, ready to hit the streets. Big Jim was nodding and giving him a thumbs up in spite of the cuss word. Randolph felt himself expand, unaware the words would come back to haunt him. I will take no shit from anybody. 4. When Julia Shumway came into Sweetbriar Rose that morning, most of the breakfast crowd had departed either for church or impromptu forums on the common. It was 9 o'clock. Barbie was on his own. Neither Dodie Sanders nor Angie McCain had shown up, which surprised no one. Rose had gone to Food City. Anson went with her. Hopefully they'd come back loaded with groceries, but Barbie wouldn't let himself believe it until he actually saw the goodies. We're closed until lunch, he said, but there's coffee. And a cinnamon roll? Julia asked hopefully. Barbie shook his head. Rose didn't make them, trying to conserve the Jenny as much as possible. Makes sense, she said. Just coffee, then. He carried the pot with him and poured. You look tired. Barbie, everyone looks tired this morning and scared to death. How's that paper coming? I was hoping to have it out by 10, but it's looking more like 3 this afternoon. The first Democrat extra since the Prestille flooded in 03. Production problems? Not as long as my generator stays online. I just want to go down to the grocery store and see if a mob shows up. Get that part of the story, if one does. Pete Freeman's already there to take pictures. Barbie didn't like that word, mob. Christ, I hope they behave. They will. This is the Mill, after all, not New York City. Barbie wasn't sure there was that much difference between city mice and country mice when they were under stress. But he kept his mouth shut. She knew the locals better than he did. And Julia, as if reading his mind. Of course, I could be wrong. That's why I sent Pete. She looked around. There were still a few people at the counter up front, finishing eggs and coffee, and of course the big table at the back. The bullshit table, in Yankee parlance, was full of old men chewing over what had happened and discussing what might happen next. The center of the restaurant, however, she and Barbie had to themselves.
"Couple of things to tell you," she said in a lower voice. "Stop hovering like Willy the waiter and sit down."
Barbie did so and poured his own cup of coffee. It was the bottom of the pot and tasted like diesel. But of course the bottom of the pot was where the caffeine motherlode was. Julia reached into the pocket of her dress, brought out her cell, and slid it across to him.
"Your man Cox called again at 7 this morning. Guess he didn't get much sleep last night either. Asked me to give you this. Doesn't know you have one of your own."
Barbie let the phone stay where it was. If he expects a report already, he's seriously overestimated my abilities.
He didn't say that. He said that if he needed to talk to you, he wanted to be able to reach out.
That decided Barbie. He pushed the cell phone back to her. She took it, not looking surprised.
He also said that if you didn't hear from him by 5 this afternoon, you should call him. He'll have an update. Want the number with the funny area code?
He sighed. Sure. She wrote it on a napkin. Small, neat numbers.
I think they're going to try something.
What?
He didn't say. It was just a sense I got that a number of options are on the table.
I'll bet there are. What else is on your mind?
Who says there's anything?
It's just a sense I get, he said, grinning.
Okay. The Geiger counter.
I was thinking I'd speak to Al Timmons about that. Al was the town hall janitor and a regular at Sweetbriar Rose. Barbie got on well with him. Julia shook her head. No. Why no?
Want to guess who gave Al a personal no-interest loan to send Al's youngest son to Heritage Christian in Alabama?
Would that be Jim Rennie?
Right. Now let's go on to Double Jeopardy, where the scores can really change. Guess who holds the paper on Al's Fisher plow?
I'm thinking that would also be Jim Rennie.
Correct. And since you're the dog shit selectman Rennie can't quite scrape off his shoe, reaching out to people who owe him might not be a good idea.
She leaned forward.
But it so happens that I know who had a complete set of the keys to the kingdom. Town hall, hospital, health center, schools, you name it.
Who?
Our late police chief, and I happen to know his wife, widow, very well. She has no love for James Rennie. Plus, she can keep a secret if someone convinces her it needs keeping.
Julia, her husband isn't even cold yet. Julia thought of the grim little Bowie funeral parlor and made a grimace of sorrow and distaste.
Maybe not, but he's probably down to room temperature. I take your point, though, and applaud your compassion, but...
She grasped his hand.
This surprised Barbie, but didn't displease him. These aren't ordinary circumstances, and no matter how broken-hearted she is, Brenda Perkins will know that. You have a job to do. I can convince her of that. You're the inside man.
The inside man, Barbie said, and was suddenly visited by a pair of unwelcome memories. A gymnasium in Fallujah, and a weeping Iraqi man, naked, save for his unraveling hijab. After that day in that gym, he had stopped wanting to be an inside man. And yet here he was.
So, shall I?
It was a warm morning for October, and although the door was now locked, people could leave but not re-enter. The windows were open. Through those facing Main Street, there now came a hollow, metallic bang and a yelp of pain. It was followed by cries of protest. Barbie and Julia looked at each other across their coffee cups with identical expressions of surprise and apprehension. It begins right now, Barbie thought. He knew that wasn't true. It had begun yesterday when the dome came down. But at the same time, he felt sure it was true. The people at the counter were running to the door. Barbie got up to join them, and Julia followed. Down the street, at the north end of the town common, the bell in the steeple of the First Congregational Church began to ring, summoning the faithful to worship. 5. Junior Rennie felt great. He had not so much as a shadow of a headache this morning, and breakfast was sitting easy in his stomach. He thought he might even be able to eat lunch. That was good. He hadn't had much use for food lately. Half the time just looking at it made him feel throw-uppy. Not this morning, though. Flapjacks and bacon, baby. If this is the apocalypse, he thought, it should have come sooner. Each special deputy had been partnered with a regular full-time officer. Junior drew Freddie Denton, and that was also good. Denton, balding but still trim at 50, was known as a serious hard-ass. But there were exceptions. He had been president of the Wildcat Boosters Club during Junior's high school football years, and it was rumored he had never given a varsity football player a ticket. Junior couldn't speak for all of them, but he knew that Frankie DeLesseps had been let off by Freddie once, and Junior himself had been given the old, "I'm not going to write you up this time, but slow down," routine twice. Junior could have been partnered with Weddington, who probably thought a first down was finally letting some guy into her pants. She had a great rack. But can you say loser? Nor had he cared for the cold-eyed look she gave him after the swearing-in, as he and Freddie passed her on their way to the street. "Got a little leftover pantry space for you, if you fuck with me, Jackie," he thought, and laughed. God, the heat and light on his face felt good. How long since it had felt so good? Freddie looked over. "Something funny, James?"
"Nothing in particular," Junior said. "I'm just on a roll, that's all."
Their job this morning at least was to foot patrol Main Street. "To announce our presence," Randolph had said. First up one side and down the other. Pleasant enough duty in the warm October sunshine. They were passing Mill Gas and Grocery when they heard Ray's voices from inside. One belonged to Johnny Carver, the manager and part owner. The other was too slurry for Junior to make out, but Freddie Denton rolled his eyes.
"Sloppy Sam Verdreau as I live and breathe," he said. "Shit, and not even 9:30. "Who's Sam Verdreau?" Junior asked.
Freddie's mouth tightened down to a white line Junior recognized from his football days. It was Freddie's, "Ah, fuck, we're behind," look. Also his, "Ah, fuck, that was a bad call," look. "You've been missing the better class of Mill Society, Junes, but you're about to get introduced." Carver was saying, "I know it's past 9, Sammy, and I see you've got money, but I still can't sell you any wine. Not this morning, not this afternoon, not tonight. Probably not tomorrow either, unless this mess clears itself up. That's from Randolph himself. He's the new chief."
"Like fuck his,"
the other voice responded, but it was so slurry it came to Junior's ears, sounding as
"le fuzz." "Pete Randolph ain't but shit lint on Duke Perkins' asshole. Duke's dead and Randolph says no booze sales. I'm sorry, Sam." "Just one bottle of T-Bird," Sam whined. "Just one barf T-Bird. I need it. And I can pay for it. Come on, how long I been trading here?" "Well, shit."
Although he sounded disgusted with himself, Johnny was turning to look at the wall-long case of beer and vino as Junior and Freddie came up the aisle. He had probably decided a single bottle of Bird would be a small price to get the old rum pot out of his store, especially since a number of shoppers were watching and avidly awaiting further developments. The hand-printed sign on the case said absolutely, "No alcohol sales until further notice." But the wussy was reaching for the booze just the same, the stuff in the middle. That was where the cheap-ass popskull lived. Junior had been on the force less than 2 hours, but he knew that was a bad idea. If Carver caved into the straggle-haired wino, other less disgusting customers would demand the same privilege. Freddie Denton apparently agreed.
"Don't do that," he told Johnny Carver.
And to Verdreau, who was looking at him with the red eyes of a mole caught in a brush fire, "I don't know if you have enough working brain cells left to read the sign, but I know you heard the man, no alcohol today, so get in the breeze, quit smelling up the place."
"You can't do that, officer," Sam said, drawing himself up to his full 5.5 feet.
He was wearing filthy chinos, a Led Zeppelin t-shirt, and old slippers with busted backs. His hair looked as if it had last been cut while Bush, too, was riding high in the polls.
"I got my rights. Free country. Says so right in the Constitution of Independence." "The Constitution's been canceled in the mill," Junior said, with absolutely no idea that he was speaking prophecy. "So put an egg in your shoe and beat it."
God, how fine he felt. In barely a day he had gone from doom and gloom to boom and zoom.
"But,"
Sam stood there for a moment with his lower lip trembling, trying to muster more arguments. Junior observed with disgust and fascination that the old fuck's eyes were getting wet. Sam held out his hands, which were trembling far worse than his loose mouth. He only had one more argument to make, but it was a hard one to bring out in front of an audience. Because he had to. He did.
I really need it, Johnny. No joke, just a little to stop the shakes. I'll make it last. And I won't get up to no Dickens. Swear my mother's name, I'll just go home.
Home for Sloppy Sam was a shack sitting in a gruesomely bald dooryard, dotted with old auto parts.
Maybe I ought to, Johnny Carver began. Freddy ignored him. Sloppy, you never made a bottle last in your life.
Don't you call me that, Sam Verdreau cried.
The tears overspilled his eyes and slid down his cheeks.
Your fly's unzipped, old-timer, Junior said. And when Sam looked down at the crotch of his grimy chinos, Junior stroked a finger up the flabby underside of the old man's chin, and then tweaked his beak. A grammar school trick, sure, but it hadn't lost its charm. Junior even said what they'd said back then.
Dirty clothes got your nose.
Freddy Denton laughed. So did a couple of other people. Even Johnny Carver smiled, although he didn't look as if he really wanted to. Get out of here, Sloppy, Freddy said. It's a nice day. You don't want to spend it in a cell. But something, maybe being called Sloppy, maybe having his nose tweaked, maybe both, had relit some of the rage that had awed and frightened Sam's mates when he'd been a lumberjockey on the Canadian side of the Miramichi 40 years before. The tremble disappeared from his lips and hands, at least temporarily. His eyes lighted on Junior, and he made a phlegmy but undeniably contemptuous throat-clearing sound. When he spoke, the slur had left his voice.
Fuck you, kid. You ain't no cop, and you was never much of a football player. Couldn't even make the college B team, is what I heard.
His gaze switched to Officer Denton.
And you, deputy dog. Sunday sales legal after 9 o'clock. Has been since the 70s, and that's the end of that tale.
Now it was Johnny Carver he was looking at. Johnny's smile was gone, and the watching customers had grown very silent. One woman had a hand to her throat.
I got money, coin of the realm, and I'm taking what's mine.
He started around the counter. Junior grabbed him by the back of the shirt and the seat of the pants, whirled him around, and ran him toward the front of the store.
Hey! Sam shouted as his feet bicycled above the old, oiled boards. Take your hands off me! Take your fucking hands!
Out through the door and down the steps, Junior holding the old man out in front of him. He was light as a bag of feathers, and Christ, he was farting! Pow, 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 like a damn machine gun. Stubby Norman's panel truck was parked at the curb, the one with furniture bought and sold and top prices for antiques on the side. Stubby himself stood beside it with his mouth open. Junior didn't hesitate. He ran the blabbering old drunk headfirst into the side of the truck. The thin metal gave out a mellow bong. It didn't occur to Junior that he might have killed the smelly fuck until Sloppy Sam dropped like a rock, half on the sidewalk and half in the gutter. But it took more than a smack against the side of an old truck to kill Sam Verdreau, or silence him. He cried out, then just began to cry. He got to his knees. Scarlet was pouring down his face from his scalp where the skin had split. He wiped some away, looked at it with disbelief, then held out his dripping fingers. Foot traffic on the sidewalk had halted so completely that someone might have called a game of statues. Pedestrians stared with wide eyes at the kneeling man holding out a palm full of blood.
I'll sue this whole fucking town for police brutality, Sam bawled. And I'll win.
Freddy came down the store steps and stood beside Junior.
Go ahead, say it, Junior told him.
Say what?
I overreacted.
The fuck you did. You heard what Pete said. Take no shit from anybody. Partner, that deal starts here and now.
Partner. Junior's heart lifted at the word.
You can't throw me out when I got money, Sam raved. You can't beat me up. I'm an American citizen. I'll see you in court.
Good luck on that one, Freddy said.
The courthouse is in Castle Rock, and from what I hear, the road going there is closed. He hauled the old man to his feet. Sam's nose was also bleeding, and the flow had turned his shirt into a red bib. Freddy reached around to the small of his back for a set of his plastic cuffs.
Gotta get me some of those, Junior thought admiringly.
A moment later, they were on Sam's wrists. Freddy looked around at the witnesses, those on the street, those crowding the doorway of the gas and grocery.
This man is being arrested for public disturbance, interfering with police officers, and attempted assault, he said in a bugling voice Junior remembered well from his days on the football field.
Hectoring from the sidelines, it had never failed to irritate him. Now it sounded delightful. Guess I'm growing up, Junior thought.
He is also being arrested for violating the new no-alcohol rule instituted by Chief Randolph. Take a good look.
Freddy shook Sam. Blood flew from Sam's face and filthy hair.
We've got a crisis situation here, folks, but there's a new sheriff in town, and he intends to handle it. Get used to it, deal with it, learn to love it. That's my advice. Follow it, and I'm sure we'll get through this situation just fine. Go against it, and...
He pointed to Sam's hands, plastic cuffed behind him. A couple of people actually applauded. For Junior Rennie, the sound was like cold water on a hot day. Then, as Freddy began to frog march the bleeding old man up the street, Junior felt eyes on him. The sensation so clear it might have been fingers poking the nape of his neck. He turned, and there was Dale Barbara, standing with the newspaper editor, and looking at him with flat eyes. Barbara, who had beaten him up pretty good that night in the parking lot, who'd marked all three of them, before sheer weight of numbers had finally begun to turn things around. Junior's good feelings began to depart. He could almost feel them flying up through the top of his head like birds, or bats from a belfry.
What are you doing here? He asked Barbara.
I've a better question, Julia Shumway said. She was wearing her tight little smile. What are you doing, brutalizing a man who's a quarter your weight and three times your age? Junior could think of nothing to say. He felt blood rush into his face and fan out on his cheeks. He suddenly saw the newspaper bitch in the McCain pantry, keeping Angie and Dodie company. Barbara, too. Maybe lying on top of the newspaper bitch, as if he were enjoying a little of the old something-something. Freddy came to Junior's rescue. He spoke calmly. He wore the stolid policeman's face known the world over.
Any questions about police policy should go to the new chief, ma'am. In the meantime, you'd do well to remember that for the time being. We're on our own. Sometimes, when people are on their own, examples have to be made.
Sometimes, when people are on their own, they do things they regret later, Julia replied, usually when the investigations start. The corners of Freddy's mouth turned down. Then he hauled Sam down the sidewalk.
Junior looked at Barbie a moment longer, then said, You want to watch your mouth around me, and your step.
He touched a thumb deliberately to his shiny new badge. Perkins is dead, and I'm the law. Junior, Barbie said, you don't look so good. Are you sick? Junior looked at him from eyes that were a little too wide. Then he turned and went after his new partner. His fists were clenched. 6. In times of crisis, folks are apt to fall back on the familiar for comfort. That is as true for the religious as it is for the heathen. There were no surprises for the faithful in Chester's Mill that morning. Piper Libby preached hope at the Congo, and Lester Coggins preached hellfire at Christ the Holy Redeemer. Both churches were packed. Piper's scripture was from the book of John. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. She told those who filled the pews of the Congo church that prayer was important in times of crisis, the comfort of prayer, the power of prayer. But it was also important to help one another, depend on one another, and love one another.
God tests us with things we don't understand, she said. Sometimes it's a sickness. Sometimes it's the unexpected death of a loved one.
She looked sympathetically at Brenda Perkins, who sat with her head bowed and her hands clasped in the lap of a black dress.
And now it's some inexplicable barrier that has cut us off from the outside world. We don't understand it, but we don't understand sickness or pain or the unexpected deaths of good people either. We ask God why. And in the Old Testament, the answer is the one he gave to Job. Were you there when I made the world? In the New and more enlightened Testament, it's the answer Jesus gave to his disciples. Love one another as I have loved you. That's what we have to do today, and every day, until this thing is over. Love one another, help one another, and wait for the test to end, as God's tests always do.
Lester Coggan's scripture came from Numbers, a section of the Bible not known for optimism. Behold, ye have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Like Piper, Lester mentioned the testing concept, an ecclesiastical hit during all the great cluster mugs of history, but his major theme had to do with the infection of sin and how God dealt with such infections, which seemed to be squeezing them with his fingers the way a man might squeeze a troublesome pimple until the pus squirted out like holy Colgate. And because even in the clear light of a beautiful October morning, he was still more than half convinced that the sin for which the town was being punished was his own, Lester was particularly eloquent. There were tears in many eyes, and cries of, "Yes, Lord," rang from one amen corner to the other. When he was this inspired, great new ideas sometimes occurred to Lester, even as he was preaching. One occurred to him this day, and he articulated it at once, without so much as a pause for thought. It needed no thought. Some things are just too bright, too glowing not to be right. This afternoon I'm going out to where Route 119 strikes God's mysterious gate, he said.
Yes, Jesus,
a weeping woman cried. Others clapped their hands or raised them in testimony. I reckon 2 o'clock. I'm going to get on my knees out there in that dairy field, yay! And I'm going to pray to God to lift this affliction. This time the cries of Yes, Lord, and Yes, Jesus, and God knows it were louder. But first, Lester raised the hand with which he had whipped his bare back in the dark of night. First, I'm going to pray about the sin that has caused this pain and this sorrow and this affliction. If I am alone, God may not hear me. If I am with 2 or 3 or even 5, God still may not hear me. Can you say amen? They could. They did. All of them were holding up their hands now and swaying from side to side, caught up in that good God fever. But if you all were to come out, if you were to pray in a circle right there in God's grass under God's blue sky, within sight of the soldiers, they say, a God in the work of God's righteous hand. If you all were to come out, if we all were to pray together, then we might be able to get to the bottom of this sin and drag it out into the light to die and work a God Almighty miracle. Will you come? Will you get knee-bound with me? Of course they would come. Of course they would get knee-bound. People enjoy an honest-to-God prayer meeting in good times and bad. And when the band swung into Whate'er My God Ordains Is Right, key of G, Lester on lead guitar, they sang fit to raise the roof. Jim Rennie was there, of course. It was Big Jim who made the carpool arrangements. 7. End the secrecy. Free Chester's Mill. Demonstrate. Where? The Dinsmore Dairy Farm on Route 119. Just look for the wrecked truck and the military agents of oppression. When? 2 p.m. EOT, Eastern Oppression Time. Who? You and every friend you can bring. Tell them we want to tell our story to the media. Tell them we want to know who did this to us. And why? Most of all, tell them we want out. This is our town. We need to fight for it. We need to take it back. Some signs available, but be sure and bring your own. And remember that profanity is counterproductive. Fight the power. Stick it to the man. The Committee to Free Chester's Mill. 8. If there was one man in town who could take that old Nietzschean saying, "Whatever does not kill me makes me stronger," as his personal motto, that man was Romeo Burpee.
a hustler with a daddy cool Elvis pomp, and pointed boots with elastic sides. He owed his first name to a romantic Franco-American mother, his last to a hard-assed Yankee father who was practical to his dry pinch-penny core. Romeo had survived a childhood of merciless taunts, plus the occasional beating, to become the richest man in town. Well, no, Big Jim was the richest man in town, but much of his wealth was of necessity hidden. Romy owned the largest and most profitable indie department store in the entire state. Back in the 80s, his potential backers in the venture had told him he was mad to go with such a frankly ugly name as Burpees. Romy's response had been that if the name hadn't hurt Burpee Seeds, it wouldn't hurt him. And now their biggest summer sellers were t-shirts reading, "Meet me for Slurpees at Burpees. Take that, you imagination-challenged bankers." He had succeeded in large measure by recognizing the main chance and pursuing it ruthlessly. Around 10 that Sunday morning, not long after he'd watched Sloppy Sam hauled off to the cop shop, another main chance rolled around, as they always did, if you watch for them. Romeo observed children putting up posters, computer-generated and very professional-looking. The kids, most on bikes, a couple on skateboards, were doing a good job of covering Main Street. A protest demonstration out on 119. Romeo wondered whose idea that had been. He caught up with one and asked,
"It was my idea," Joe McClatchy said.
"No shit."
"No shit whatsoever," Joe said.
Romy tipped the kid $5, ignoring his protests and tucking it deep into his back pocket. Information was worth paying for. Romy thought people would go to the kid's demonstration. They were crazy to express their fear, frustration, and righteous anger. Shortly after sending Scarecrow Joe on his way, Romeo began to hear people talking about an afternoon prayer meeting to be held by Pastor Coggins. Same by God time, same by God place. Surely a sign. One reading, "Sales opportunity here." Romeo went into his store, where business was lackadaisical. The people Sunday shopping today were either doing it at Food City or Mill Gas and Grocery, and they were the minority. Most were either at church or at home watching the news. Toby Manning was behind the cash register, watching CNN on a little battery-powered TV.
"Shut off that quack and close down your register," Romeo said.
"Really, Mr. Burpee?"
"Yes. Drag the big tent out of storage. Get Lily to help you."
"The summer blowout sale tent?"
"That's the baby," Romeo said. "We're going to pitch it in that cowgrass where Chuck Thompson's plane crashed."
"Alden Dinsmore's field? What if he wants money to use it?"
"Then we'll pay him."
Romeo was calculating. The store sold everything, including discount grocery items, and he currently had roughly 1,000 packs of discount Happy Boy Franks in the industrial freezer behind the store. He'd bought them from Happy Boy HQ in Rhode Island, company now defunct, little microbe problem, thank God not E. coli, expecting to sell them to tourists and locals planning 4th of July cookouts. Hadn't done as well as he'd expected, thanks to the goddamn recession, but had held onto them anyway, as stubbornly as a monkey holding onto a nut. And now maybe serve them on those little garden sticks from Taiwan, he thought. I've still got 1 billion of those bastards. Call them something cute, like Frank-a-ma-bobs. Plus, they had maybe 100 cartons of yummy tummy lemonade and limeade powder, another discount item on which he'd expected to take a loss. "We are going to want to pack up all the Blue Rhino, too." Now his mind was clicking away like an adding machine, which was just the way Romeo liked it to click. Toby was starting to look excited.
"What you got in mind, Mr. Burpee?"
Romy went on inventorying stuff he'd expected to record on his books as a dead loss. Those cheap shit pinwheels. Leftover 4th of July sparklers. The stale candy he'd been saving for Halloween.
"Toby," he said, "we're going to throw the biggest damn cookout and field day this town has ever seen. Get moving, we've got a lot to do."
9. Rusty was making hospital rounds with Dr. Haskell when the walkie-talkie Linda had insisted he carry buzzed in his pocket. Her voice was tinny, but clear.
"Rusty, I have to go in after all.
Randolph says it looks like half the town is going to be out at the barrier on 119 this afternoon. Some for a prayer meeting, some for a demonstration. Romeo Burpee is going to pitch a tent and sell hot dogs, so expect an influx of gastroenteritis patients this evening.
Rusty groaned.
I'll have to leave the girls with Marta after all.
Linda sounded defensive and worried, a woman who knew there was suddenly not enough of her to go around.
I'll fill her in on Janny's problem.
Okay. He knew if he told her to stay home, she would. And all he'd accomplish would be to worry her just when her worries were starting to settle a bit. And if a crowd did show up out there, she'd be needed.
Thank you, she said. Thank you for understanding.
Just remember to send the dog to Marta's with the girls, Rusty said. You know what Haskell said. Dr. Ron Haskell, the Whiz, had come up big for the Everett family this morning. Had come up big ever since the onset of the crisis, really. Rusty never would have expected it, but he appreciated it. And he could see, by the old guy's pouched eyes and drooping mouth, that Haskell was paying the price. The Whiz was too old for medical crises. Snoozing in the third-floor lounge was more his speed these days. But other than Ginny Tomlinson and Twitch, it was now just Rusty and the Whiz holding the fort. It was bad luck all around that the dome had crashed down on a beautiful weekend morning when anyone who could get out of town had done so. Haskell, although pushing 70, had stayed at the hospital with Rusty last night until 11, when Rusty had literally forced him out the door, and he'd been back by 7 this morning, when Rusty and Linda arrived with daughters in tow, also with Audrey, who seemed to take the new environment of Kathy Russell calmly enough. Judy and Janelle had walked on either side of the big golden, touching her for comfort. Janelle had looked scared to death.
What's with the dog?
Haskell asked, and when Rusty filled him in, Haskell had nodded and said to Janelle,
Let's check you out, hon.
Will it hurt?
Janelle had asked apprehensively.
Not unless getting a piece of candy after I look in your eyes hurts.
When the exam was over, the adults left the two girls and the dog in the examining room and went into the hall. Haskell's shoulders were slumped. His hair seemed to have whitened overnight.
What's your diagnosis, Rusty?
Haskell had asked. Petit mal. I think brought on by excitement and worry, but Audie's been doing that whining thing of hers for months.
Right. We'll start her on Zorontin. You agree?
Yes. Rusty had been touched to be asked. He was beginning to regret some of the mean things he'd said and thought about Haskell.
And keep the dog with her, yes?
Absolutely.
Will she be all right, Ron?
Linda asked. She'd had no plans to work then. Her plan then had been to spend the day in quiet activities with the girls.
She is all right, Haskell said. Many children suffer petit mal seizures. Most have only one or two. Others have more over a course of years and then stop. There's rarely any lasting damage.
Linda looked relieved. Rusty hoped she would never have to know what Haskell wasn't telling her. That instead of finding their way out of the neurological thicket, some unlucky kids went in deeper, progressing to grand mal. And grand mal seizures could do damage. They could kill. Now, after finishing morning rounds, only half a dozen patients, one a new mom with no complications, and hoping for a cup of coffee before jetting over to the health center, this call from Linda.
I'm sure Marta will be fine with having Audie, she said.
Good. You'll have your cop walkie while you're on duty, right?
Yes, of course.
Then give your personal walkie to Marta. Agree on a comm channel. If something should go wrong with Janelle, I'll come on the run.
All right. Thanks, Honey Bunch. Is there any chance you could get out there this afternoon?
As Rusty considered that, he saw Dougie Twitchell coming down the hall. He had a cigarette tucked behind his ear and was walking in his usual don't-give-a-shit amble. But Rusty saw concern on his face.
I might be able to play hooky for an hour, no promises.
I understand, but it would be so great to see you.
You too. Be careful out there and tell folks not to eat the hot dogs. Burpee's probably had them in cold storage for 10,000 years.
Those are his mastodon steaks, Linda said. Over and out, sweet man. I'll look for you.
Rusty stuck the walkie in the pocket of his white coat and turned to Twitch.
What's up? And get that cigarette out from behind your ear. This is a hospital.
Twitch plucked the cigarette from its resting place and looked at it.
I was going to smoke it out by the storage shed.
Not a good idea, Rusty said. That's where the extra propane's stored.
That's what I came to tell you. Most of the tanks are gone.
Bullshit, those things are huge. I can't remember if they hold 3,000 gallons each or 5,000.
So, what are you saying? I forgot to look behind the door?
Rusty began to rub his temples. If it takes them, whoever they are, more than 3 or 4 days to short out that force field, we're going to need mucho LP.
Tell me something I don't know,
Twitch said.
According to the inventory card on the door, there's supposed to be 7 of those puppies, but there are only 2.
He stowed the cigarette in the pocket of his own white coat.
I checked the other shed, just to make sure. Thought somebody might have moved the tanks.
Why would anyone do that?
I don't know, oh great one. Anyway, the other shed's for the really important hospital supplies, gardening and landscaping shit. In that one, the tools are present and accounted for, but the fucking fertilizer's gone.
Rusty didn't care about the fertilizer. He cared about the propane.
Well, if push comes to shove, we'll get some from the town supplies.
You'll get a fight from Rennie.
When Kathy Russell might be his only option if that ticker of his vapor locks, I doubt it. You think there's any chance I can get away for a while this afternoon?
That'd be up to the whiz.
He now appears to be the ranking officer.
Where is he?
Sleeping in the lounge. Snores like a mad bastard, too. You want to wake him up?
No, Rusty said. Let him sleep. I'm not going to call him the Wiz anymore. Given how hard he's worked since this shit came down, I think he deserves better.
Ah, so, Sensei, you have reached a new level of enlightenment.
Blow me, Grasshopper, Rusty said.
10. Now see this. See it very well. It's 2:40 p.m. on another eye-bustingly gorgeous autumn day in Chester's Mill. If the press were not being kept away, they'd be in photo op heaven, and not just because the trees are in full flame. The imprisoned people of the town have migrated to Alden Dinsmore's dairy field en masse. Alden has struck a use fee deal with Romeo Burpee, $600. Both men are happy. The farmer, because he jacked the businessman up considerable from Burpee's starting offer of $200, Romeo, because he would have gone to 1,000, if pressed. From the protesters and Jesus shouters, Alden collected not a single crying dime. That doesn't mean he isn't charging them, however. Farmer Dinsmore was born at night, but not last night. When this opportunity came along, he marked out a large parking area just north of the place where the fragments of Chuck Thompson's plane came to rest the day before, and there he has stationed his wife, Shelley, his older son, Ollie. You remember Ollie. And his hired man, Manuel Ortega, a no-green card Yankee who can aya with the best of them. Alden's knocking down $5 a car, a fortune for a shirt-tailed dairyman who for the last 2 years has been keeping his farm out of Keyhole Bank's hands by the skin of his teeth. There are complaints about the fee, but not many. They charge more to park at the Freiburg Fair, and unless folks want to park by the side of the road, which has already been lined on both sides by early arrivals, and then walk half a mile to where all the excitement is, they have no choice. And what a strange and varied scene. A 3-ring circus for sure, with the ordinary citizens of the mill and all the starring roles. When Barbie arrives with Rose and Ants Wheeler, the restaurant is closed again, will reopen for supper, just cold sandwiches, no grill orders. They stare in open-mouthed silence. Both Julia Shumway and Pete Freeman are taking pictures. Julia stops long enough to give Barbie her attractive but somehow inward-turning smile.
Some show, wouldn't you say?
Barbie grins.
Yes'm.
In the first ring of this circus, we have the townsfolk who have responded to the posters put up by Scarecrow Joe and his cadre. The protest turnout has been quite satisfying, almost 200, and the 60 signs the kids made, the most popular, "Let us out, damn it," were gone in no time. Luckily, many people did bring their own signs. Joe's favorite is the one with prison bars inked over a map of the mill. Lissa Jameson is not just holding it, but pumping it aggressively up and down. Jack Evans is there, looking pale and grim. His sign is a collage of photographs featuring the woman who bled to death the day before. "Who killed my wife?" it screams. Scarecrow Joe feels sorry for him. But what an awesome sign. If the press could see that one, they'd fill their collective pants with joy shit. Joe organized the protesters into a big circle that rotates just in front of the dome, which is marked by a line of dead birds on the Chester's Mill side. Those on the Motton side have been removed by the military personnel. The circle gives all of Joe's people, for so he thinks of them, a chance to wave their signs at the posted guards, who stand with their backs resolutely and maddeningly turned. And Joe also gave out printed chant sheets. He wrote these with Benny Drake's skateboarding idol, Nori Calvert. Besides being balls to the wall on her blitz deck, Nori's rhymes are simple but tight, yo. One chant goes, ha ha ha, he he he, Chester's mill must be set free. Another, you did it, come on out and just admit it. Joe has, with real reluctance, vetoed another Nori masterpiece that goes, take off the gags, take off the gags, let us talk to the press, you fags. We have to be politically correct about this, he told her. What he's wondering just now is if Nori Calvert is too young to kiss, and if she would slip him any tongue if he did. He has never kissed a girl, but if they're all going to die like starving bugs trapped under a Tupperware bowl, he probably should kiss this one while there's still time. In the second ring is Pastor Coggins' prayer circle. They are really getting God-sent. And, in a fine show of ecclesiastical detente, the Holy Redeemer Choir has been joined by a dozen men and women from the Congo Church Choir. They're singing A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, and a good number of unaffiliated townsfolk who know the words have joined in. Their voices rise to the blameless blue sky, with Lester's shrill exhortations and the prayer circle's supporting cries of Amen and Hallelujah weaving in and out of the singing in perfect counterpoint, although not harmony, that would be going too far. The prayer circle keeps growing as other townsfolk drop to their knees and join in, laying their signs temporarily aside so they can raise their clasped hands in supplication. The soldiers have turned their backs. Perhaps God has not. But the center ring of this circus is the biggest and most bodacious. Romeo Burpee pitched the end-of-summer blowout sail tent well back from the dome and 60 yards east of the prayer circle, calculating the location by testing the faint gasp of breeze that's blowing. He wants to make sure that the smoke from his rank of hibachis reaches both those praying and those protesting. His only concession to the afternoon's religious aspect is to make Toby Manning turn off his boombox, which was blaring that James McMurtry song about living in a small town. It didn't mix well with How Great Thou Art and Won't You Come to Jesus. Business is good and will only get better. Of this Romeo is sure. The hot dogs, thawing even as they cook, may gripe some bellies later, but they smell perfect in the warm afternoon sun, like a county fair instead of chow time in prison. Kids race around waving pinwheels and threatening to set Dinsmore's grass on fire with leftover 4th of July sparklers, empty paper cups that held either citrus powder drinks, foul, or hastily brewed coffee, fouler still, are littered everywhere. Later on, Romeo will have Toby Manning pay some kid, maybe Dinsmore's $10, to pick up the litter. Community relations, always important. Right now, though, Romeo's totally focused on his jackleg cash register, a carton that once contained charm and toilet paper. He takes in long green and returns short silver. It's the way America does business, honey bunch. He's charging $4 per dog, and he's goddamn if people aren't paying it. He expects to clear at least $3,000 by sundown, maybe a lot more. And look, here's Rusty Everett. He got away after all. Good for him. He almost wishes he'd stopped to get the girls. They would surely enjoy this. And it might allay their fears to see so many people having a good time. But it might be a little too much excitement for Janny. He spots Linda at the same time she spots him and starts waving frantically, practically jumping up and down. With her hair done in the stubby, fearless police girl braids she almost always wears when she's working, Lynn looks like a junior high school cheerleader. She is standing with Twitch's sister Rose and the young man who short orders at the restaurant. Rusty's a little surprised. He thought Barbara had left town. Got on Big Jim Rennie's bad side. A bar fight is what Rusty heard, although he wasn't on duty when the participants came in to get patched up. Fine by Rusty. He's patched up his share of Dipper's customers. He hugs his wife, kisses her mouth, then plants a kiss on Rose's cheek, shakes hands with the cook, and gets reintroduced. Look at all these hot dogs, Rusty mourns. Oh, dear. Better line of the bedpans, Doc, Barbie says, and they all laugh. It's amazing to be laughing under these circumstances. But they aren't the only ones, and good God, why not? If you can't laugh when things go bad, laugh and put on a little carnival.
then you're either dead or wishing you were.
This is fun,
Rose says, unaware of how soon the fun is going to end. A frisbee floats past. She plucks it out of the air and wings it back to Benny Drake, who leaps to catch it, and then spins to throw it on to Nori Calvert, who catches it behind her back. Show off. The prayer circle prays. The mixed choir, really finding its voice now, has moved on to that all-time chart-topper Onward Christian Soldiers. A child no more than Judy's age bops past, skirt flapping around her chubby knees, a sparkler clutched in one hand, and a cup of the awful limeade in the other. The protesters turn and turn in a widening gyre, chanting, "Ha, ha, ha, he, 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 Chester's mill must be set free." Overhead, puffy clouds with shady bottoms float northward from Motton, and then divide as they near the soldiers, skirting around the dome. The sky directly overhead is a cloudless, flawless blue. There are those in Dinsmore's field who study those clouds and wonder about the future of rain in Chester's Mill. But nobody speaks of this aloud. "I wonder if we'll still be having fun next Sunday," Barbie says. Linda Everett looks at him. It's not a friendly look.
"Surely you think before then..."
Rose interrupts her.
"Look over there. That kid shouldn't be driving that damn rig so fast. He'll tip it over. I hate those ATVs."
They all look at the little vehicle with the fat balloon tires and watch as it cuts a diagonal through the October white hay. Not toward them, exactly, but certainly toward the dome. It's going too fast. A couple of the soldiers hear the approaching engine and finally turn around.
"Oh, Christ, don't let him crash," Linda Everett moaned.
Rory Dinsmore doesn't crash. It would have been better if he had. 11. An idea is like a cold germ. Sooner or later, someone always catches it. The Joint Chiefs had already caught this one. It had been kicked around at several of the meetings attended by Barbie's old boss, Colonel James O. Cox. Sooner or later, someone in the mill was bound to be infected by the same idea, and it wasn't entirely surprising that the someone should turn out to be Rory Dinsmore, who was by far the sharpest tool in the Dinsmore family box.
"I don't know where he gets it from," Shelley Dinsmore said, when Rory brought home his first all-A's rank card,
and she said it in a voice more worried than proud. If he'd lived in town, and if he'd had a computer, which he did not, Rory would undoubtedly have been a part of Scarecrow Joe McClatchy's posse. Rory had been forbidden to attend the carnival prayer meeting demonstration. Instead of eating weird hot dogs and helping with the car park operation, he was ordered by his father to stay at home and feed the cows. When that was done, he was to grease their udders with bag balm, a job he hated.
"And once you got those teats nice and shiny," his father said, "you could sweep the barns and bust up some hay bales."
He was being punished for approaching the dome yesterday after his father had expressly forbidden it, and actually knocking on it, for God's sake. Appealing to his mother, which often worked, did no good this time.
"You could have been killed," Shelley said. "Also, your dad says you mouthed off."
"Just told him the cook's name," Rory protested. And for that, his father once more had gone upside his head, while Ollie looked on with smug and silent approval.
"You're too smart for your own good," Alden said.
Safely behind his father's back, Ollie had stuck out his tongue. Shelley saw, however, and went upside Ollie's head. She did not, however, forbid him the pleasures and excitements of that afternoon's makeshift fair.
"And you leave that goddamn go-kart alone," Alden said, pointing to the ATV parked in the shade between Dairy Barns 1 and 2. "You need to move hay, you carry it. It'll build you up a little."
Shortly thereafter, the dim Dinsmores went off together, walking across the field toward Romeo's tent. The bright one was left behind with a hay fork and a jar of bag balm as big as a flower pot. Rory went about his chores glumly but thoroughly. His racing mind sometimes got him in trouble. But he was a good son for all that, and the idea of ditching punishment chores never crossed his mind. At first, nothing crossed his mind. He was in that mostly empty-headed stead of grace which is sometimes such fertile soil. It's the ground from which our brightest dreams and biggest ideas, both the good and the spectacularly bad, suddenly burst forth, often full-blown. yet there is always a chain of association. As Rory began sweeping Barn One's main aisle, he would save the hateful udder greasing for last, he reckoned. He heard a rapid pop-pow-pam that could only be a string of firecrackers. They sounded a little like gunshots. This made him think of his father's rifle, which was propped in the front closet. The boys were forbidden to touch it except under strict supervision, while shooting at targets or in hunting season. But it wasn't locked up, and the ammo was on the shelf above it. And the idea came. Rory thought, I could blow a hole in that thing. Maybe pop it. He had an image bright and clear of touching a match to the side of a balloon. He dropped the broom and ran for the house. Like many bright people, especially bright children, inspiration rather than consideration was his strong suit. If his older brother had had such an idea, unlikely. Ollie would have thought, if a plane couldn't bust through it or a pulp truck going full tilt, what chance does a bullet have? He might also have reasoned, I'm in Dutch already for disobeying, and this is disobedience raised to the ninth power. Well, no, Ollie probably wouldn't have thought that. Ollie's mathematical abilities had topped out at simple multiplication. Rory, however, was already taking college track algebra and knocking it dead. If asked how a bullet could accomplish what a truck or an airplane hadn't, he would have said the impact effect of a Winchester Elite XP3 would be far greater than either. It stood to reason. For one thing, the velocity would be greater. For another, the impact itself would be concentrated upon the point of a 180-grain bullet. He was sure it would work. It had the unquestionable elegance of an algebraic equation. Rory saw his smiling, but of course modest, face on the front page of USA Today, being interviewed on Nightly News of Brian Williams, sitting on a flower-bedecked float in a parade in his honor with prom queen-type girls surrounding him, probably in strapless gowns, but possibly in bathing suits. As he waved to the crowd and confetti floated down in drifts, he would be the boy who saved Chester's Mill. He snatched the rifle from the closet, got the step stool, and pawed a box of XP3s down from the shelf. He stuffed two cartridges into the breech, one for a backup, then raced back outside with the rifle held above his head like a conquering rebelista. But give him this, he engaged the safety without even thinking about it. The key to the Yamaha ATV he had been forbidden to ride was hanging on the pegboard in Barn 1. He held the key fob between his teeth while he strapped the rifle to the back of the ATV with a couple of bungee cords. He wondered if there would be a sound when the dome popped. He probably should have taken the shooter's plugs from the top shelf of the closet, but going back for them was unthinkable. He had to do this now. That's how it is with big ideas. He drove the ATV around Barn 2, pausing just long enough to size up the crowd in the field. Excited as he was, he knew better than to head for where the dome crossed the road, and where the smudges of yesterday's collisions still hung like dirt on an unwashed windowpane. Someone might stop him before he could pop the dome. Then, instead of being the boy who saved Chester's Mill, he'd likely wind up as the boy who greased Cowtit for a year. Yes, and for the first week he'd be doing it in a crouch, his ass too sore to sit down. Someone else would end up getting the credit for his big idea. So he drove on a diagonal that would bring him to the dome 500 yards or so from the tent, marking the place to stop by the crushed spots in the hay. Those, he knew, had been made by falling birds. He saw the soldiers stationed in that area turn toward the oncoming blat of the ATV. He heard shouts of alarm from the fair and prayer folks. The hymn singing came to a discordant halt. Worst of all, he saw his father waving his dirty John Deere cap at him and bawling, Rory, oh God damn it, you stop! Rory was in too deep to stop, and, good son or not, he didn't want to stop. The ATV struck a hummock, and he bounced clear of the seat, holding on with his hands and laughing like a loon. His own deer cap was spun around backward, and he didn't even remember doing it. The ATV tilted, then decided to stay up. Almost there now. And one of the fatigues-clad soldiers was also shouting at him to stop. Rory did. And so suddenly he almost somersaulted over the Yamaha's handlebars. He forgot to put the darn thing in neutral, and it lurched forward, actually striking the dome, before stalling out. Rory heard the crimp of metal, and the tinkle of the headlight as it shattered. The soldiers, afraid of being hit by the ATV, the eye which sees nothing to block an oncoming object triggers powerful instincts, fell off to either side, leaving a nice big hole and sparing Rory the need of telling them to move away from a possible explosive blowout. He wanted to be a hero, but didn't want to hurt or kill anybody to do it. He had to hurry. The people closest to his stopping point were the ones in the parking lot and clustered around the summer blowout sail tent, and they were running like hell. His father and brother were among them, both screaming at him to not do whatever he was planning to do. Rory yanked the rifle free of the bungee cords, socked the butt plate into his shoulder, and aimed at the invisible barrier 5 feet above a trio of dead sparrows. "No, kid, bad idea," one of the soldiers shouted. Rory paid him no mind because it was a good idea. The people from the tent and the parking lot were close now. Someone, it was Lester Coggins, who ran a lot better than he played guitar, shouted, "In the name of God, son, don't do that!" Rory pulled the trigger. No, only tried to. The safety was still on. He looked over his shoulder and saw the tall, thin preacher from the Holy Roller Church blow past his puffing, red-faced father. Lester's shirt tail was out and flying. His eyes were wide. The cook from Sweetbriar Rose was right behind him. They were no more than 60 yards away now, and the Reverend looked like he was just getting into fourth gear. Rory thumbed off the safety. "No, kid, no!" the soldier cried again, simultaneously crouching on his side of the dome and holding out his splayed hands. Rory paid no attention. It's that way with big ideas. He fired. It was, unfortunately for Rory, a perfect shot. The high-impact slug struck the dome dead-on, ricocheted, and came back like a rubber ball on a string. Rory felt no immediate pain, but a vast sheet of white light filled his head as the smaller of the two slugs' two fragments thumbed out his left eye and lodged in his brain. Blood flew in a spray, then ran through his fingers as he dropped to his knees, clutching his face. 12.
"I'm blind! I'm blind!"
the boy was screaming, and Lester immediately thought of the scripture upon which his finger had landed. "Madness and blindness and astonishment of the heart."
"I'm blind! I'm blind!"
Lester pried away the boy's hands and saw the red welling socket. The remains of the eye itself were dangling on Rory's cheek. As he turned his head up to Lester, the splattered remains plopped into the grass. Lester had a moment to cradle the child in his arms before the father arrived and tore him away. That was all right. That was as it should be. Lester had sinned and begged guidance from the Lord. Guidance had been given and answer provided. He knew now what he was to do about the sins he'd been led into by James Rennie. A blind child had shown him the way. This is not as bad as it gets. 1. What Rusty Everett would recall later was confusion. The only image that stuck out with complete clarity was Pastor Coggins' naked upper body, fish belly white skin, and stacked ribs. Barbie, however, perhaps because he'd been tasked by Colonel Cox to put on his investigator's hat again, saw everything. And his clearest memory wasn't of Coggins with his shirt off. It was of Melvin Searles pointing a finger at him and then tilting his head slightly. Sign language any man recognizes as meaning, "We ain't done yet, sunshine." What everyone else remembered, what brought the town situation home to them as perhaps nothing else could, were the father's cries, as he held his wretched, bleeding boy in his arms, and the mother screaming.
"Is he all right, Alden? Is he all right?"
as she labored her 60 pounds overweight bulk toward the scene. Barbie saw Rusty Everett push through the circle gathering around the boy and join the two kneeling men, Alden and Lester. Alden was cradling his son in his arms as Pastor Coggins stared with his mouth sagging like a gate with a busted hinge. Rusty's wife was right behind him. Rusty fell on his knees between Alden and Lester and tried to pull the boy's hands away from his face. Alden, not surprisingly in Barbie's opinion, promptly socked him one. Rusty's nose started to bleed.
"No, let him help,"
the PA's wife yelled. Linda, Barbie thought, her name is Linda, and she's a cop.
No, Alden, no!
Linda put her hand on the farmer's shoulder, and he turned, apparently ready to sock her. All sense had departed his face. He was an animal protecting a cub. Barbie moved forward to catch his fist, if the farmer let it fly, then had a better idea. Medic here, he shouted, bending into Alden's face and trying to block Linda from his field of vision. Medic, medic, med... Barbie was yanked backward by the collar of his shirt and spun around. He had just time enough to register Mel Searles, one of Junior's buddies, and to realize that Searles was wearing a blue uniform shirt and a badge.
This is as bad as it gets, Barbie thought.
But as if to prove him wrong, Searles socked him in the face, just as he had that night in Dipper's parking lot. He missed Barbie's nose, which had probably been his target, but mashed Barbie's lips back against his teeth. Searles drew back his fist to do it again, but Jackie Weddington, Mel's unwilling partner that day, grabbed his arm before he could. "Don't do it," she shouted. "Officer, don't do it." For a moment the issue was in doubt. Then Ollie Dinsmore, closely followed by his sobbing, gasping mother, passed between them, knocking Searles back a step. Searles lowered his fist.
"Okay," he said. "But you're in a crime scene, asshole. Police investigation scene. Whatever."
Barbie wiped his bleeding mouth with the heel of his hand and thought, "This is not as bad as it gets. That's the hell of it. It's not." 2. The only part of this Rusty heard was Barbie shouting, "Medic." Now he said it himself. "Medic, Mr. Dinsmore, Rusty Everett, you know me. Let me look at your boy."
"Let him, Alden," Shelley cried. "Let him take care of Rory."
Alden relaxed his grip on the kid, who was swaying back and forth on his knees, his blue jeans soaked with blood. Rory had covered his face with his hands again. Rusty took hold of them, gently, gently does it, and pulled them down. He had hoped it wouldn't be as bad as he feared, but the socket was raw and empty, pouring blood, and the brain behind that socket was hurt plenty. The news was in how the remaining eye cocked senselessly skyward, bulging at nothing. Rusty started to pull his shirt off, but the preacher was already holding out his own. Coggan's upper body, thin and white in front, striped with criss-crossing red welts in back, was running with sweat. He held the shirt out. "No," Rusty said. "Rip it, rip it." For a moment, Lester didn't get it. Then he tore the shirt down the middle. The rest of the police contingent was arriving now, and some of the regular cops, Henry Morrison, George Frederick, Jackie Weddington, Freddie Denton, were yelling at the new special deputies to help move the crowd back, make some space. The new hires did so, and enthusiastically. Some of the rubberneckers were knocked down, including that famous Bratz torturer, Samantha Bushy. Sammy had little Walter in a papoose carrier, and when she went on her ass, both of them began to squall. Junior Rennie stepped over her without so much as a look and grabbed Rory's mom, almost pulling the wounded boy's mother off her feet before Freddie Denton stopped him. "No, Junior, no. It's the kid's mother. Let her loose."
"Police brutality,"
Sammy Bushy yelled from where she lay in the grass.
"Police brutality."
Georgia Rue, the newest hire in what had become Peter Randolph's police department, arrived with Carter Thibodeau, holding his hand, actually. Georgia pressed her boot against one of Sammy's breasts, it wasn't quite a kick, and said,
"Yo, Dyke, shut up."
Junior let go of Rory's mother and went to stand with Mel, Carter, and Georgia. They were staring at Barbie. Junior added his eyes to theirs, thinking that the cook was like a bad goddamn penny that kept turning up. He thought Barbie would look awfully good in a cell right next to Sloppy Sam's. Junior also thought that being a cop had been his destiny all along. It had certainly helped with his headaches. Rusty took half of Lester's torn shirt and ripped it again. He folded a piece, started to put it over the gaping wound in the boy's face, then changed his mind and gave it to the father. "Hold it to the..." The words barely came out. His throat was full of blood from his mashed nose. Rusty hawked it back, turned his head, spat a half-clotted loogie into the grass, and tried again. "Hold it to the wound, Dad. Apply pressure. Hand to the back of his neck and squeeze."
Dazed but willing, Alden Dinsmore did as he was told. The makeshift pad immediately turned red, but the man seemed calmer nonetheless. Having something to do helped. It usually did. Rusty flung the remaining piece of shirt at Lester. "More," he said, and Lester began ripping the shirt into smaller pieces. Rusty lifted Dinsmore's hand and removed the first pad, which was now soaked and useless. Shelley Dinsmore shrieked when she saw the empty socket.
"Oh, my boy! My boy!"
Peter Randolph arrived at a jog, huffing and puffing. Still, he was far ahead of Big Jim, who, mindful of his substandard ticker, was plodding down the slope of the field on grass the rest of the crowd had trampled into a broad path. He was thinking of what a cluster mug this had turned out to be. Town gatherings would have to be by permit only in the future, and if he had anything to do with it, he would. He always did. Permits would be hard to come by.
"Move these people back further,"
Randolph snarled at Officer Morrison. And as Henry turned to do so, "Move it back, folks! Give them some air!" Morrison bawled, "Officers, form a line! Push them back! Anyone who resists, put them in cuffs!" The crowd began a slow reverse shuffle. Barbie lingered. "Mr. Everett, Rusty, do you need any help? Are you okay?" "Fine," Rusty said, and his face told Barbie everything he needed to know. The PA was all right. Just a bloody nose. The kid wasn't. And never would be again. Even if he lived. Rusty applied a fresh pad to the kid's bleeding eye socket and put the father's hand over it again. "Nape of the neck," he said. "Press hard. Hard." Barbie started to step back. But then the kid spoke. 3.
"It's Halloween. We can't..."
Rusty froze in the act of folding another piece of shirt into a compression pad. Suddenly he was back in his daughter's bedroom listening to Janelle scream, "It's the Great Pumpkin's fault." He looked up at Linda. She had heard too. Her eyes were big, the color fleeing her previously flushed cheeks.
"Linda," Rusty snapped at her, "get on your walkie, call the hospital, tell Twitch to get the ambulance."
"The fire!"
Rory Dinsmore screamed in a high, trembling voice. Lester was staring at him as Moses might have stared at the burning bush.
"The fire! The bus is in the fire! Everyone's screaming! Watch out for Halloween!"
The crowd was silent now, listening to the child rant. Even Jim Rennie heard as he reached the back of the mob and began to elbow his way through.
"Linda," Rusty shouted, "get on your walkie. We need the ambulance."
She started visibly, as if someone had just clapped his hands in front of her face. She pulled the walkie-talkie off her belt. Rory tumbled forward into the flattened grass and began to seize.
"What's happening?"
That was the father.
"Oh, dear, to Jesus, he's dying."
That was the mother. Rusty turned the trembling, bucking child over, trying not to think of Janie as he did it, but that, of course, was impossible, and tilting his chin up to create an airway. "Come on, Dad," he told Alden. "Don't quit on me now. Squeeze the neck. Compression on the wound. Let's stop the bleeding." Compression might drive the fragment that had taken the kid's eye deeper in, but Rusty would worry about that later, if that was the kid didn't die right out here on the grass. From nearby, but oh so far, one of the soldiers finally spoke up. Barely out of his teens, he looked terrified and sorry. "We tried to stop him. Boy didn't listen. There wasn't nothing we could do." Pete Freeman, his Nikon dangling by his knee on its strap, favored this young warrior with a smile of singular bitterness. "I think we know that. If we didn't before, we sure do now."
4.
Before Barbie could melt into the crowd, Mel Searles grabbed him by the arm. "Take your hand off me," Barbie said mildly. Searles showed his teeth in a version of a grin. "In your dreams, fucko." Then he raised his voice.
"Chief! Hey, Chief!"
Peter Randolph turned toward him impatiently, frowning.
"This guy interfered with me while I was trying to secure the scene. Can I arrest him?"
Randolph opened his mouth, possibly to say, "Don't waste my time." Then he looked around. Jim Rennie had finally joined the little group watching Everett work on the boy. Rennie gave Barbie the flat stare of a reptile on a rock, then looked back at Randolph and nodded slightly. Mel saw it. His grin widened.
Jackie, Officer Weddington, I mean. Can I borrow a pair of your cuffs?
Junior and the rest of his crew were also grinning. This was better than watching some bleeding kid, and a lot better than policing a bunch of holy rollers and dumbbells with signs.
Payback's a bitch, Barbie,
Junior said. Jackie looked dubious.
Pete, Chief, I mean, I think the guy was only trying to
Cuff him up, Randolph said. We'll sort out what he was or wasn't trying to do later. In the meantime, I want this mess shut down.
He raised his voice.
It's over, folks. You've had your fun, and see what it's come to. Now go home.
Jackie was removing a set of plastic cuffs from her belt. She had no intention of handing them to Mel Searles, would put them on herself. When Julia Shumway spoke up, she was standing just behind Randolph and Big Jim. In fact, Big Jim had elbowed her aside on his way to where the action was.
I wouldn't do that, Chief Randolph, unless you want the PD embarrassed on the front page of the Democrat.
She was smiling her Mona Lisa smile.
With you so new to the job and all.
What are you talking about?
Randolph asked. His frown was deeper now, turning his face into a series of unlovely crevices. Julia held up her camera, a slightly older version of Pete Freeman's.
I have quite a few pictures of Mr. Barbara assisting Rusty Everett with that wounded child, a couple of Officer Searles hauling Mr. Barbara off for no discernible reason, and one of Officer Searles punching Mr. Barbara in the mouth, also for no discernible reason. I'm not much of a photographer, but that one is really quite good. Would you like to see it, Chief Randolph? You can. The camera's digital.
Barbie's admiration for her deepened because he thought she was running a bluff. If she'd been taking pictures, why was she holding the lens cap in her left hand, as if she'd just taken it off?
It's a lie, Chief, Mel said. He tried to take a swing at me. Ask Junior.
I think my pictures will show that young Mr. Rennie was involved in crowd control and had his back turned when the punch landed, Julia said.
Randolph was glowering at her.
I could take your camera away, he said. Evidence.
You certainly could, she agreed cheerily, and Pete Freeman would take a picture of you doing it.
Then you could take Pete's camera, but everyone here would see you do it.
Whose side are you on here, Julia? Big Jim asked. He was smiling his fierce smile, the smile of a shark about to take a bite out of some plump swimmer's ass. Julia turned her own smile on him, the eyes above it as innocent and inquiring as a child's.
Are there sides, James? Other than over there? She pointed at the watching soldiers. And in here?
Big Jim considered her, his lips now bending the other way, a smile in reverse. Then he flapped one disgusted hand at Randolph.
I guess we'll let it slide, Mr. Barbara, Randolph said. Heat of the moment.
Thanks, Barbie said. Jackie took her glowering young partner's arm.
Come on, Officer Searles. This part's over. Let's move these people back.
Searles went with her, but not before turning to Barbie and making the gesture. Finger pointing, head cocked slightly. We ain't done yet, sunshine. Romy's assistant, Toby Manning, and Jack Evans appeared, carrying a makeshift stretcher made out of canvas and tent poles. Romy opened his mouth to ask what the hell they thought they were doing, then closed it again. The field day had been canceled anyway. So what the hell?
5. Those with cars got into them. Then they all tried to drive away at the same time.
Predictable, Joe McClatchy thought. Totally predictable.
Most of the cops worked to unclog the resulting traffic jam, although even a bunch of kids, Joe was standing with Benny Drake and Nori Calvert, could tell that the new and improved 5-0 had no idea what it was doing. The sound of popo curses came clear on the summery air.
Can't you back that son of a whore up?
In spite of the mess, nobody seemed to be laying on their horns. Most folks were probably too bummed to beep.
Benny said, Look at those idiots. How many gallons of gas do you think they're blowing out their tailpipes? Like, they think the supply's endless.
Word,
Nori said.
She was a tough kid, a small-town riot girl with a modified Tennessee top-hat mullet do. But now she only looked pale, and sad, and scared. She took Benny's hand. Scarecrow Joe's heart broke, then remended itself in an instant when she took his as well. "There goes the guy who almost got arrested," Benny said, pointing with his free hand. Barbie and the newspaper lady were trudging across the field toward the makeshift parking lot with 60 or 80 other people, some dragging their protest signs dispiritedly behind them.
"Nancy Newspaper wasn't taking pictures at all, you know," Scarecrow Joe said. "I was standing right behind her. Pretty foxy."
"Yeah," Benny said, "but I still wouldn't want to be him. Till this shit ends, the cops can do pretty much what they want."
That was true, Joe reflected.
And the new cops weren't particularly nice guys. Junior Rennie, for example. The story of Sloppy Sam's arrest was already making the rounds.
"What are you saying?"
Nori asked Benny.
"Nothing right now. It's still cool right now," he considered. "Fairly cool. But if this goes on... Remember Lord of the Flies?"
They had read it for Honors English. Benny intoned, "Kill the pig, cut her throat, bash her in.
People call cops pigs, but I'll tell you what I think. I think cops find pigs when the shit gets deep. Maybe because they get scared too."
Nori Calvert burst into tears. Scarecrow Joe put an arm around her. He did it carefully, as if he thought doing such a thing might cause them both to explode. But she turned her face against his shirt and hugged him. It was a one-armed hug, because she was still holding on to Benny with her other hand. Joe thought he had felt nothing in his whole life as weirdly thrilling as her tears dampening his shirt. Over the top of her head, he looked at Benny reproachfully.
"Sorry, dude," Benny said, and patted her back. "No fear."
"His eye was gone,"
she cried. The words were muffled against Joe's chest. Then she let go of him.
"This isn't fun anymore. This is not fun."
"No." Joe spoke as if discovering a great truth. "It isn't."
"Look,"
Benny said. It was the ambulance. Twitch was bumping across Dinsmore's field with the red roof lights flashing. His sister, the woman who owned Sweetbriar Rose, was walking ahead of him, guiding him around the worst potholes. An ambulance in a hayfield, under a bright afternoon sky in October. It was the final touch. Suddenly, Scarecrow Joe no longer wanted to protest. Nor did he exactly want to go home. At that moment, the only thing in the world he wanted was to get out of town. 6. Julia slid behind the wheel of her car but didn't start it. They were going to be here a while, and there was no sense in wasting gas. She leaned past Barbie, opened the glove compartment, and brought out an old pack of American Spirits.
"Emergency supplies," she told him apologetically. "Do you want one?"
He shook his head.
"Do you mind, because I can wait?"
He shook his head again. She lit up, then blew smoke out her open window. It was still warm, a real Indian summer day for sure, but it wouldn't stay that way. Another week or so and the weather would turn wrong, as the old-timer said. Or maybe not, she thought. Who in the hell knows? If the dome stayed in place, she had no doubt that plenty of meteorologists would weigh in on the subject of the weather inside, but so what? The Weather Channel Yodas couldn't even predict which way a snowstorm would turn. And in Julia's opinion, they deserved no more credence than the political geniuses who blabbed their days away at the Sweetbriar Rose bullshit table.
"Thanks for speaking up back there," he said. "You saved my bacon."
"Here's a newsflash, honey. Your bacon's still hanging in the smokehouse. What are you going to do next time? Have your friend Cox call the ACLU? They might be interested, but I don't think anyone from the Portland office is going to be visiting Chester's Mill soon."
"Don't be so pessimistic. The dome might blow out to sea tonight. Or just dissipate. We don't know."
"Fat chance. This is a government job, some governments, and I'll bet your Colonel Cox knows it."
Barbie was silent. He had believed Cox when Cox said the U.S. hadn't been responsible for the dome. Not because Cox was necessarily trustworthy, but because Barbie just didn't think America had the technology. Or any other country, for that matter. But what did he know? His last service job had been threatening scared Iraqis. Sometimes with a gun to their heads. Junior's friend Frankie DeLessich was out on Route 119 helping to direct traffic. He was wearing a blue uniform shirt over jeans. There probably hadn't been any uniform pants in his size at the station. He was a tall son of a bitch. And, Julia saw with misgivings, he was wearing a gun on his hip. Smaller than the Glocks the regular mill police carried. Probably his own property. But it was a gun. All right.
What will you do if the Hitler Youth comes after you? She asked, lifting her chin in Frankie's direction. Good luck hollering police brutality if they jug you and decide to finish what they started. There's only two lawyers in town, one senile and the other drives a Boxster Jim Rennie got him at discount. Or so I've heard.
I can take care of myself.
Ooh, macho.
What's up with your paper? It looked ready when I left last night.
Technically speaking, you left this morning, and yes, it's ready. Pete and I and a few friends will make sure it gets distributed. I just didn't see any point in starting while the town was 3/4 empty. Want to be a volunteer newsboy?
I would, but I've got a zillion sandwiches to make. Strictly cold food at the restaurant tonight.
Maybe I'll drop by.
She tossed her cigarette, only half-smoked, from the window. Then, after a moment's consideration, she got out and stepped on it. Starting a grass fire out here would not be cool. Not with the town's new fire truck stranded in Castle Rock.
I swung by Chief Perkins' house earlier, she said as she got back behind the wheel. Except, of course, it's just Brenda's now.
How is she?
Terrible. But when I said you wanted to see her and that it was important, although I didn't say what it was about, she agreed. After dark might be best. I suppose your friend will be impatient.
Stop calling Cox my friend. He is not my friend. They watched silently as the wounded boy was loaded into the back of the ambulance. The soldiers were still watching, too. Probably against orders. And that made Julia feel a little better about them. The ambulance began to buck its way back across the field, lights flashing.
This is terrible, she said, in a thin voice.
Barbie put an arm around her shoulders. She tensed for a moment, then relaxed. Looking straight ahead, at the ambulance, which was now turning into a cleared lane in the middle of Route 119, she said,
What if they shut me down, my friend? What if Rennie and his pet police decide to shut my little newspaper down?
That's not going to happen, Barbie said. But he wondered. If this went on long enough, he supposed every day in Chester's Mill would become Anything Can Happen Day.
She had something else in her mind, Julia Shumway said.
Mrs. Perkins?
Yes, it was in many ways a very strange conversation.
She's grieving for her husband, Barbie said. Grief makes people strange. I said hello to Jack Evans. His wife died yesterday when the dome came down, and he looked at me as if he didn't know me, although I've been serving him my famous Wednesday meatloaf since last spring.
I've known Brenda Perkins since she was Brenda Morse, Julia said. Almost 40 years. I thought she might tell me what was troubling her, but she didn't.
Barbie pointed at the road.
I think you can go now.
As Julia started the engine, her cell phone trilled. She almost dropped her bag in her hurry to dig it out. She listened, then handed it to Barbie with her ironic smile.
It's for you, boss.
It was Cox, and Cox had something to say, quite a lot, actually. Barbie interrupted long enough to tell Cox what had happened to the boy, now headed to Kathy Russell. But Cox either didn't relate Rory Dinsmore's story to what he was saying, or didn't want to. He listened politely enough, then went on. When he finished, he asked Barbie a question that would have been in order had Barbie still been in uniform and under his command.
Sir, I understand what you're asking, but you don't understand that... I guess you'd call it the political situation here, and my little part in it. I had some trouble before this dome thing, and...
We all know about that, Cox said. An altercation with the second selectman's son and some of his friends. You were almost arrested, according to what I've got in my folder.
A folder? Now he's got a folder. God help me.
That's fine intel as far as it goes, Barbie said, but let me give you a little more. One, the police chief who kept me from being arrested died out on 119, not far from where I'm talking to you, in fact. Faintly, in a world he could not now visit, Barbie heard paper rattle. He suddenly felt he would like to kill Colonel James O. Cox with his bare hands, simply because Colonel James O. Cox could go out for Mickey D's any time he wanted, and he, Dale Barbara, could not.
We know about that, too, Cox said. A pacemaker problem.
Two, Barbie went on, the new chief, who is asshole buddies with the only powerful member of this town's board of selectmen, has hired some new deputies. They're the guys who tried to beat my head off my shoulders in the parking lot of the local nightclub.
Oh, you'll have to rise above that, won't you, Colonel?
Why are you calling me Colonel? You're the Colonel.
Congratulations, Cox said. Not only have you re-enlisted in your country's service, you've gotten an absolutely dizzying promotion.
No, Barbie shouted. Julia was looking at him with concern, but he was hardly aware of it.
No, I don't want it.
Yeah, but you got it, Cox said calmly. I'm going to email a copy of the essential paperwork to your editor friend before we shut down your unfortunate little town's internet capacity.
Shut it down? You can't shut it down.
The paperwork is signed by the president himself. You going to say no to him? I understand he can be a tad grumpy when he's crossed. Barbie didn't reply. His mind was whirling.
You need to visit the selectmen and the police chief, Cox said. You need to tell them the president has invoked martial law in Chester's Mill. And you're the officer in charge. I'm sure you'll encounter some initial resistance, but the information I've just given you should help establish you as the town's conduit to the outside world. And I know your powers of persuasion. Saw them firsthand in Iraq.
Sir, he said, you have so misread the situation here. He ran a hand through his hair. His ear was throbbing from the goddamn cell phone.
It's as if you can comprehend the idea of the dome, but not what's happening in this town as a result of it. And it's been less than 30 hours.
Help me understand, then. You say the president wants me to do this. Suppose I were to call him up and tell him he can kiss my rosy red ass. Julia was looking at him horrified, and this actually inspired him. Suppose, in fact, I said I was a sleeper Al-Qaeda agent, and I was planning to kill him. Pow, one to the head. How about that?
Lieutenant Barbara. Colonel Barbara, I mean, you've said enough.
Barbie did not feel this was so. Could he send the FBI to come and grab me? The Secret Service? The goddamn Red Army? No, sir, he could not.
We have plans to change that, as I have just explained.
Cox no longer sounded loose and good-humored, just one old grunt talking to another. And if it works, feel free to have the federal agency of your choice come and arrest me, but if we stay cut off, who in here is going to listen to me? Get it through your head. This town has seceded. Not just from America, but from the whole world. There's nothing we can do about it, and nothing you can do about it either. Quietly, Cox said,
we're trying to help you guys.
You say that, and I almost believe you. Will anybody else around here? When they look to see what kind of help their taxes are buying them, they see soldiers standing guard with their backs turned. That sends a hell of a message.
You're talking a whole lot for someone who's saying no.
I'm not saying no, but I'm only about 9 feet from being arrested, and proclaiming myself the Commandant Pro Tem won't help.
Suppose I were to call the first selectman, what's his name, Sanders, and tell him.
That's what I mean by how little you know. It's like Iraq all over again, only this time you're in Washington instead of boots on the ground, and you seem as clueless as the rest of the desk soldiers. Read my lips, sir. Some intelligence is worse than no intelligence at all.
A little learning is a dangerous thing, Julia said dreamily.
If not Sanders, then who?
James Rennie, the second selectman. He's the boss hog around here. There was a pause. Then Cox said,
maybe we can give you the internet. Some of us are of the opinion that cutting it off's just a knee-jerk reaction anyway.
Why would you think that? Barbie asked. Don't you guys know that if you let us stay on the net, Aunt Sarah's cranberry bread recipe is sure to get out sooner or later? Julia sat up straight and mouthed, they're trying to cut the internet? Barbie raised one finger toward her.
Wait. Just hear me out, Barbie. Suppose we call this Rennie and tell him the internet's got to go. So sorry, crisis situation, extreme measures, etc., etc. Then you can convince him of your usefulness by changing our minds.
Barbie considered. It might work, for a while, anyway. Or it might not.
Plus, Cox said brightly, you'll be giving them this other information. Maybe saving some lives. But saving people the scare of their lives, for sure.
Barbie said, phones stay up as well as internet.
That's hard. I might be able to keep the net for you, but listen, man, there are at least 5 Curtis LeMay types sitting on the committee presiding over this mess. And as far as they're concerned, everyone in Chester's Mill is a terrorist until proved otherwise.
What can these hypothetical terrorists do to harm America?
suicide bombed the Congo church?
Barbie, you're preaching to the choir.
Of course, that was probably the truth.
Will you do it?
I'll have to get back to you on that. Wait for my call before you do anything. I have to talk to the late police chief's widow first. Cox persisted.
Will you keep the horse trading part of this conversation to yourself?
Again, Barbie was struck by how little even Cox, a free thinker by military standards, understood about the changes the dome had already wrought. In here, the Cox brand of secrecy no longer mattered. Us against them, Barbie thought. Now it's us against them. Unless their crazy idea works, that is. Sir, I really will have to get back to you on that. This phone is suffering a bad case of low battery.
A lie he told with no remorse.
And you need to wait to hear from me before you talk to anybody else.
Just remember, the Big Bang's scheduled for 1300 tomorrow. If you want to maintain viability on this, you better stay out front.
Maintain viability, another meaningless phrase under the dome. Unless it applied to keeping your Jenny supplied with propane. We'll talk, Barbie said. He closed the phone before Cox could say more. 119 was almost clear now. Although de Lesseps was still there, leaning against his vintage muscle car with his arms folded. As Julia drove past the Nova, Barbie noted a sticker reading, Ass, Gas, or Grass. Nobody rides for free. Also a police bubblegum light on the dash. He thought the contrast summed up everything that was now wrong in Chester's Mill. As they rode, Barbie told her everything Cox had said. What they're planning is really no different than what that kid just tried, she said, sounding appalled. Well, a little different, Barbie said. The kid tried it with a rifle. They've got a cruise missile lined up. Call it the Big Bang Theory. She smiled. It wasn't her usual one. Wan and bewildered. It made her look 60 instead of 43. I think I'm going to be putting out another paper sooner than I thought. Barbie nodded. Extra, extra, read all about it. 7.
Hello, Sammy. Someone said. How are you?
Samantha Bushy didn't recognize the voice, and turned toward it warily, hitching up the papoose carrier as she did. Little Walter was asleep and he weighed a ton. Her butt hurt from falling on it. And her feelings were hurt, too, that damned Georgia Rue calling her a dyke. Georgia Rue, who had come whining around Sammy's trailer more than once, looking to score an 8-ball for her and the muscle-bound freak she went around with. It was Dodie's father. Sammy had spoken with him thousands of times, but she hadn't recognized his voice. She hardly recognized him. He looked old and sad. Broken, somehow. He didn't even scope out her boobs, which was a first.
Hi, Mr. Sanders. Gee, I didn't even see you at the...
She flapped her hand back toward the flattened-down field in the big tent, now half-collapsed and looking forlorn, although not as forlorn as Mr. Sanders.
I was sitting in the shade.
That same hesitant voice, coming through an apologetic hurting smile that was hard to look at.
I had something to drink, though. Wasn't it warm for October? Golly, yes. I thought it was a good afternoon, a real town afternoon, until that boy...
Oh, Crispy Crackers, he was crying.
I'm awful sorry about your wife, Mr. Sanders.
Thank you, Sammy, that's very kind. Can I... Carry your baby back to your car for you. I think you can go now. The road's almost clear.
That was an offer Sammy couldn't refuse, even if he was crying. She scooped little Walter out of the papoose. It was like picking up a big clump of warm bread dough and handed him over. Little Walter opened his eyes, smiled glassily, belched, then went back to sleep.
I think he might have a package in his diaper, Mr. Sanders said.
Yeah, he's a regular shit machine. Good old little Walter.
Walter's a very nice old-fashioned name.
Thanks.
Telling him that her baby's first name was actually Little didn't seem worth the trouble. And she was sure she'd had that conversation with him before anyway, he just didn't remember. Walking with him like this, even though he was carrying the baby, was the perfect bummer end to a perfect bummer afternoon. At least he was right about the traffic. The automotive mosh pit had finally cleared out. Sammy wondered how long it would be before the whole town was riding bicycles again.
I never liked the idea of her in that plane, Mr. Sanders said.
He seemed to be picking up the thread of some interior conversation.
Sometimes I even wondered if Claudie was sleeping with that guy.
Doty's mom sleeping with Chuck Thompson? Sammy was both shocked and intrigued.
Probably not, he said, and sighed. In any case, it doesn't matter now. Have you seen Doty? She didn't come home last night.
Sammy almost said sure yesterday afternoon. But if the Dodster hadn't slept at home last night, saying that would only worry the Dodster's dadster. And let Sammy in for a long conversation with a guy who had tears streaming down his face and a snot runner hanging from one nostril. That would not be cool. They had reached her car, an old Chevrolet with cancer of the rocker panels. She took little Walter and grimaced at the smell. That wasn't just mail in his diaper, that was UPS and Federal Express combined.
No, Mr. Sanders, haven't seen her.
He nodded, then wiped his nose with the back of his hand. The snot runner disappeared, or at least it went somewhere else. That was a relief.
She probably went to the mall with Angie McCain, then to her Aunt Peg's in Sabattis, when she couldn't get back into town.